The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. We're going to take first Senate File 235, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is e-waste. For the fifth year in a row, it's e-waste. So everybody who's been on this committee before has heard this bill at least four times. Senator Olson, I'm sorry. We'll have to catch you up. This provides for a mechanism by which we can provide statewide recycling of video display devices. And there are a couple of data provisions in here that I think are the reason why we're in the Judiciary Committee. And one of them, Ms. Potty has prepared the A4 amendment, and I believe it's technical dealing with data, to say that the data is not public. And then changing something about a phrase about disgorgement, and maybe Ms. Pontius can tell us what that's all about. And if you can hand that out, that would be great.
Senator Higgins, I have to say that that was my request.
Well, we'll all learn what disgorgement means, I guess.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, the first part of the amendment just adds a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act because there are data provisions in this bill, and this is just a kind of a standard practice. In Chapter 13, we always try to put a cross-reference section to any other statute that deals with data or data sharing. So that's just a cross-reference, that first new section that's added.
Okay.
And then the next part of the amendment, there are a number of different tax laws that are basically just incorporated by reference in the bill, one of which, it refers to disclosure issues, and I think data practices is a better term to use. That's in Chapter 270B. And so it just changes that term. And then the last part rewrites the data language, I think consistent with the intent of the bill, just clarifies what can be shared. It also, there's a sentence in there that states that to the extent the Department of Revenue shares data with the PCA, that it retains the same classification. There's a general law that says that, so you don't need to repeat it in individual statutes, so that sentence is just deleted as well. And then the other part is to try to come up with a plain English way of using disgorgement or saying disgorgement, and this was my best attempt to try to do that in the remedies section.
And do we know what disgorgement actually meant?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I actually even looked in Black's Law Dictionary, and the term isn't used there.
The return.
The dictionary definition is not helpful. Mr. Backus and I were discussing this morning. He did a term search of Minnesota statutes and found that the term used once in one other place in all of statutes in kind of a similar context. So I've tried to kind of write what I think it means.
I appreciate that because that hadn't jumped out at me yet, and I'm sure at some point in this process it would have, and then I would have wondered what it meant too. So, Madam Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment, please.
Senator Higgins, this bill has been through another committee before
yes.
it came
yes.
to us.
So this isn't technically an author's amendment. Right. This is
That's okay. Does any of the members have any questions on the A4 amendment? I think Ms. Pontius did a good job in trying to correct the parts pertaining to data practices, which is why this bill is in our committee. Seeing none, Senator Higgins has moved the A4 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment passes. Now, Senator Higgins, on Senate File 235, as amended, just the data practices section, and I believe... And I can have Senate Counsel actually walk us through, too, Senator Higgins, on specifically the two areas that has brought this bill to the Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair, I know that we have a memo from Ms. Pontius, and if she would walk through it, she is the expert. I am not. I can talk to you about e-waste, but I don't know this.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, basically there are just two sections of the bill. The first is Section 6. And if you look at Subdivision 2, Paragraph C, and part of this was rewritten in the amendment, basically what it does is it incorporates by reference a number of enforcement provisions that apply to the Department of Revenue, which does include their data practices law. and basically treats the fees that the department is collecting under the law in the same way that sales tax data is treated, and as well as a number of other enforcement provisions applicable to sales taxes. And then with the language also in the amendment, this data could be shared. Normally, most of the Department of Revenue data is private or non-public. This data could be shared with the PCA, but just for purposes of administering these sections, because the Department of Revenue is responsible for collecting the fee under these provisions. And then there's also the language saying that they can, again, share the data. And the language where the data retain the classification, that's the sentence that was taken out in the amendment because it's not necessary. And then I also flagged Section 8. There are just some provisions in there that deal with enforcement and voiding of contracts. It specifically applies to cases where the state is purchasing video display equipment, and that's where the disgorgement remedy language was. So that was the only other place that I saw where a judiciary issue was raised.
And Madam Chair, and Ms. Pondius, on Section 8, we are working with the Department of Administration on an amendment to this because they had issues with it as well. And we thought the appropriate place to take that up would be in the next stop, state and local government.
Senator Higgins, just so that we can put these sections have come to this committee into context, can you just give us a brief overview of what e-waste is trying to do, and then we can dig back into these two provisions? Because I understand what's critical here is that at some point in the enforcement, information has to go back and forth between the Department of Revenue, or from Pollution Control Agency to the Department of Revenue. So if you could kind of give us a quick overview of the bill, what is intended to do, and then focus on that section.
If I get wandering afield,
we'll bring you back.
Okay. Madam Chair, this bill is a way to set up a statewide system for recycling of electronic waste, computer monitors, televisions, and a whole lot of things that in the very beginning of the bill are listed out for us as covered items. And this is similar to what is being done in many other states. It's called the manufacturer responsibility model. So we're setting up a statewide system of collection of the materials to be recycled. Usually, that will be done at the county level. And then the manufacturers will contact and contract with those collection points to get the e-waste back to the manufacturers for dismantling, recycling, and reuse. What we do is set up a system. Of goals to be recycled by each manufacturer based on the number of items sold in the state. Last year, you might remember that we were we had a task force trying to put this all together, and what we came up with is a sell one, recycle one. And as we have worked through with the manufacturers, they say that one-to-one is probably too rich a proportion, and what this bill calls for is a 1 to 0.8. So if you sell one, you're responsible for 0.8 recycling. And it'll be done mostly, we think, by a poundage kind of formula. So we tell the... After a lot of discussions with the manufacturers, we decided that we would allow the manufacturers to give us that material, that information about how much is sold in one of two ways. They can either tell us the exact amount sold in the state of Minnesota, if they know that, or what's more likely they tell us is that they will take their nationwide sales data and then extrapolate an amount that they think is pertinent to the state of Minnesota. I will tell you that some of the manufacturers think that we should not be doing this on a sales data, but on an amount of material that's out there to be recycled. I think that was the 2004 or maybe the beginning of the 2005 bill when we were trying to actually put that together. And we found that there were huge issues in trying to figure out what that amount could be to give people a goal to recycle. So we then went to this sales data, and I think that that's actually going to be the most workable way of doing it. Different people have different opinions on that. So that's probably one of the big data issues that we're collecting is the data on how much is sold by the manufacturers here in the state. Then I can wander way afield and tell you how we're going to collect it and all of that, and I don't know that you want to know about that. And if you do, I'll keep on talking. But
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have a question, Senator Higgins. Is are retailers responsible? Is it a one-to-one deal? You sell a video display device. Do you only then have to recycle a video display device? And if you sell things other than a video display device, like video, VCRs or DVD players, those kinds of things, I think they're under the covered electronic device. Do you also have the same requirements for those kinds of products? Is this a one-for-one thing? So if you sell everything and you recycle all the kinds of things you sell, that's all that's required? Because the only people who have to register are people who sell, I guess, televisions, the kind of thing, with computers. A video display device. Computers. I know there's some other things in there that fall under there. But
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, we started out with a one-to-one, and it's now down to 1 to 0.8. Yeah. So 8/10.
3/4.
Not quite 3/4. Yeah. 8/10. And I'm going to ask Mr. Tilley to kind of walk through the other part of that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, the way this bill is structured, the responsibility lies with the sellers of video display devices, whether it be in a TV or a computer. The requirements in the bill require a manufacturer to recycle pound for pound how much they'd sold the previous year in Minnesota. So if a manufacturer had sold 1,000 pounds for the TVs and computers, they are responsible for recycling not 1,000 but 800 pounds under the 0.8 of covered electronic devices. For the purposes of the recycling, the manufacturers are able to count the poundage of not only the TVs and the computer monitors, but also all the peripherals, the printers, the mice, the keyboards, the VCRs, the DVD players, on all of those items that are listed in covered electronic device to count against the tonnage that they have to recycle. In addition, because most of the current recycling that goes on in Minnesota happens in the metro area, the rural parts of Minnesota were concerned that they'd be left out of this, that the manufacturers would do all the easy stuff here in the metro area. So Senator Higgins' bill gives a bonus, a spiff of sorts, for recycling the stuff outside the 11-county metro area, and that is that every pound they recycle from outside of that 11-county metro area is counted 1.5 times. And so we kind of increase the incentive for a manufacturer to do the recycling in rural Minnesota as well as the easy spots in the metro area. Now, some manufacturers are going to take the initiative to set up their own recycling program because they will probably be able to recycle it easier than the 50% per pound payment to the state that they'd be required to pay under Senator Higgins' bill if they don't meet their goal. They can probably recycle it for much less than 50 cents a pound. So we expect some manufacturers to set up their own recycling program. Some of them already do a fair amount of that. So there are some very responsible manufacturers in this business. others will band together and jointly support a recycling effort to do this rather than make the payment to the state. And while then we expect some to actually make that 50 cents a pound payment to the state if they have not met their 0.8 to 1 goal.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, it's the retailer. Those are the people that are going to band together.
Senator Scheid. No, it will be the manufacturers. The retailers participate in by providing reports to the manufacturers about how many of their items they sold in Minnesota, so the retailer or the manufacturer knows how many of their items here. For instance, you might have a big retailer like Best Buy or Target who will sell lots of facilities or devices. Some of them might come from their warehouse here in Minnesota. Some might come from a warehouse in Chicago or someplace. But so the retailer is responsible for reporting to the manufacturer how many of their devices that were sold in Minnesota.
Mr. Tilley, walk us through who registers with whom and paid this registration fee. So from a data standpoint, that for us is of interest. And then tell us why there would need to be communication of certain data between the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, all of the people who manufacture the video display devices that want to sell them in Minnesota will be required to register in Minnesota and will pay the fee to register with the state. That fee does two things. One,
Mr. Tilley, and that registration is with the Department of Revenue.
That registration, Madam Chair, is with the Pollution Control Agency, the PCA.
Okay.
And the PCA communicates those registrants to the Department of Revenue, who will actually collect the payments from the manufacturers.
So members, the point for us to the reason why this bill is here is the registration with the PCA, and then the PCA then has to communicate this data to the Department of Revenue, who will then use that information to collect the registration fee. Mr. Tilley, go ahead. Can you then talk to us about the reporting requirement of the manufacturers?
Yes, Madam Chair. In the bill on page 4, page 7 in section 4, starting in line 716, you list through the manufacturer reporting requirements. And the whole purpose of all of those, and I won't read them for you, but the whole purpose of that is so the agency can determine the level of responsibility for the manufacturers. As to how much they have to recycle, and if they do not meet their recycling goal, then they will communicate their revenue on how much they expect to collect in the 50 cent per pound payment for the amount that they have not recycled.
So, Mr. Tilley, again, the registration is with the Pollution Control Agency, and the reporting requirement is coming back to the Pollution Control Agency, and the Pollution Control Agency then has to communicate that information or that data to the Department of Revenue in order to enforce the fee.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Tilley, is there anything else in the bill that has to do with reporting or data collection that ought to rise to the level of concern for this committee, other than what I've identified?
Madam Chair, I think your counsel, Ms. Pontius, identified very clearly the issues that are of major concern to this committee that I am aware of.
Any questions for Mr. Tilley or Senator Higgins on the issue that's before us? Frankly, I find that to be a little bit tiring, all this going back and forth, Mr. Tilley, but I guess for enforcement purposes, do we really need to make these people jump back and forth between the Department of Revenue and the Department of the Pollution Control Agency?
Madam Chair, actually the PCA will be doing the bulk of this communication. Revenue is only involved as it relates to collecting the money. The one thing that revenue is really, really good at is collecting revenue. That's basically what they do. We thought, and that they are the appropriate agency to receive those payments.
Well, members, I understand that generally departments can't share data unless a statute specifically allows that sharing to take place. And in general, I think data that's private in one agency, if we statutorily permit them to share it, which I think is what this is doing, right, Ms. Pontius, will be considered private once it goes to the other agency. So the private nature of it kind of travels with the information. And I would assume that in this bill, the Department of Revenue would only use the information that they need to do their job, which is the enforcement of the registration fee. So,
and to Madam Chair, if I could add, that is a very important component of this, because manufacturers are quite concerned about market share and their competition. They do not want to share necessarily those figures with the general public. It's part of the competitive marketplace. By having revenue have control of those figures as it relates to responsibility, revenue in almost exclusively keeps private all of those sort of data from all of us as individuals as well as corporations. And so they are the responsible agency to keep private that data which should be private to protect the competitive marketplace for the manufacturers.
Very good. Any questions for the witnesses? Senator Higgins. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand that completely, even when this information is within the purview of the Pollution Control Agency, there will not be any public, this will not be public information, and there won't be any data harvesting or anything of this information. That's not allowed under your bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that would not be allowed under our bill. This is really proprietary information for the corporations and all the way through in all of our years of working on this bill, that has been the one thing that we know that we had to protect was that data.
But Senator Higgins, the registration, the list of registrants, that's public information. Is that not
Madam
right?
Chair, that would be public information. I have a preliminary fiscal note, and the department estimates about 160 manufacturers who will register.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify to this committee on just this area? Recognizing that I have restrained the committee from wandering, and I've limited our discussion to this area. So, Ms. Cook?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Gerard Associates. I am representing Hewlett-Packard today. I will try to stay focused on what the committee wants to look at, although I would suggest that some of my comments, I would argue, do apply to what the committee might want to think about, but not necessarily focused on data practices. So I'm sure the chair will let me know if I'm wandering afield. Hewlett-Packard is a leader in recycling used electronics. They're about to reach 1 billion pounds recycled. That's all I will tell you about that part of it. We went through that thoroughly in the Environment Committee. Their main objective in terms of our conversation today is they want to know what their responsibility is under this bill, what they need to do to be compliant, and have a fair and reasonable penalty structure that has due process. And the ultimate penalty in this bill is that manufacturers do not get to sell their product in this state, and they could lose their ability to sell products to the state, not just consumers, but to the state, which can be very important to companies like Hewlett-Packard. And that is a three-year, they have to cancel the contracts, and they can't sell for 3 years. So we're talking about very harsh penalties. And we think it's important that the bill be very clear about what noncompliance is. Is it missing a filing date? On the reporting piece, which is something you've been talking about, I mean, the reality is whatever we report, it will simply be an estimate. We will, never get internet sales information, catalog sales information. Any national sales figures will be extrapolated. So, I mean, as you think about the data that we're sending in, it will always only ever be an estimate. So then you take something very vague and you put something very precise on it, And so we have a lot of concern about how we're going to – the ambiguity of mandatory provisions, and that it creates a substantial enforcement risk for the manufacturers that are impacted.
There's Ms. Cook, can I ask you? How does your client have any concerns about the data privacy issues that are before this committee? Does your client have any concerns that this information, where they have to do the registration or the reporting requirement, in some ways exposes them from a data privacy perspective?
Madam Chair, one of the reasons that the information is going to the Department of Revenue is because it was felt that that would be the place where the data could be kept private, because it is this is sales data and it is proprietary, albeit it's estimates, and if we start working off national sales figures, it's a little different than working off something more precise. But it is very important along the way that anything that is proprietary be kept private as this process goes on. So yes, the concern about the sharing of the information, I do believe we've worked through that, but it is a concern for them.
Thank you.
Couple other very quick issues. I think it's important for this committee to understand that the variable fee is a penalty, and it cannot be avoided. Under the bill with a 0.8-to-1 ratio, I'm using PCA numbers, if you assume that there's 39 million pounds sold here, 21 million pounds expect to be collected, which creates an 18 million pound shortfall. You're talking about a minimum of a $9 million penalty that will be assessed, assuming that every manufacturer has had a collection program. And so I think, as the Judiciary Committee, it is important to know that there is a built-in penalty, even if every ounce of expected used electronics is collected. And we have concerns about that. We also believe that the bill does not say that it's a pay or pay provision. On the one hand, there's a variable fee, and on the other hand, there's a mandatory provision on page 8 that says we just have to collect. So I'm not sure, because the bill has been through many iterations, if it just didn't work out the way we had planned. But from a manufacturer's perspective, who has huge obligations under this bill and also is facing significant penalties, including the harsh penalty of losing the ability to sell your product in the state, we are really eager to have clarification on how that works and, frankly, what compliance is. And who will determine compliance? And, frankly, we don't see, and maybe I'm just not seeing it, we don't see a due process. So if the PCA determines that we're noncompliant, I'm not convinced that there's a process in place for us to demonstrate that we are compliant prior to having our contracts voided from the state and having our product have to be pulled off the shelf. I will point out one other quick item, which is on, which I think would concern this committee. There's a requirement on page 4 that manufacturers must certify in advance that we're going to be compliant with the Act in the future. And this committee in particular might be familiar with concerns over certification and someone having to certify, A, that they're compliant, and B, that they will be compliant in the future. Considering the fact that the manufacturer does not determine whether or not they're compliant, they can certainly certify that they intend to be, hope to be, would like to be, will make every effort to, but I think it would be a stretch to suggest that anyone would want to certify that they're compliant when they don't determine that, and in fact that they would be compliant in the future. And considering changes in federal law regarding certification and Sarbanes-Oxley and other provisions, I think this is something that hopefully could be corrected along the way. It seems something not very important, but if you've got as much on the line as these manufacturers do, I think this is something that I would hope along the way we could deal with. That's the extent of my comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Higgins, on the point of an opportunity to kind of revive yourself if you sort of fell out of compliance, is there anything in the bill that's built in a process for manufacturers who maybe somehow was taken off a list because they were determined to be non-compliant?
Let me check with the Brain Trust just a second.
Will the Brain Trust please come up to the table?
Did they say in the beginning why people are recycling? Somebody's not going to
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Dunn. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Dunn?
Dunn, D-U-N-N.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn, please.
Madam Chair, I am not aware of anything which specifically sets out a process or a due process within this particular bill. However, the agency does have many enforcement responsibilities that are laid out in 115 and 116, and there are processes that we go through. It's not that the decision is made and everybody is automatically out of compliance. There are fact findings, there are opportunities for administrative hearings, there are appeals. So there are a whole plethora of different approaches that the agency uses in order to determine compliance and to bring people back into compliance. So I'm not sure that this particular bill would need something specific added to it or not. I mean, that's something we could have a conversation over before the bill progresses to the next committees. But I think that it's covered.
Let me repeat, Mr. Dunn. You're saying that there are provisions under the agency's rules and regulations and statute that says there's a process in place. And the reason why there isn't specific language in here is that this would be covered under those procedures.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding, yes.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Starting on the bottom of page 9 and on to page 10, it talks about the duties of the agency. And there are a lot of references to 115 and 116, as Mr. Dunn said. The agency's got a big role to play here in making sure that this is a success. And, they are not without a lot of experience in compliance and certifications and all those sorts of things.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Dunn, would you be contemplating that if the agency made a determination after going through the administrative process that that final decision by the agency would be appealable to district court if the manufacturer did not agree with your decision-making, or would you consider that this would be exempt from that kind of normal ability to take your decision to district court?
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not aware that there's anything here that would preclude that, because that is one of the options that's available under our normal enforcement, is to appeal to district court or to the Court of Appeals if it's an agency board decision.
Any other questions? Ms. Cook, we've put their answer on the record. You hear what the intentions are. If it's not explicitly spelled out in here, I would encourage you to work with Senator Higgins, who appears to be very open to making that language more explicit.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, I appreciate it.
Senator Higgins, what's your wish?
I don't know that there's anybody else.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify, either for or against Senate File 235?
Seeing no one moving, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 235 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state and local government ops.
On that motion, is there any further discussion among the committee members? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, can I just ask a question about one of the points that Ms. Cook raised? It was on that certification in the future. That was something that seemed a little unusual. On page 4, Subdivision 2, the manufacturer's registration, and it requires a certification under paragraph 3 that the manufacturer has complied and will continue to comply. And I never have any problem with asking people to comply and make efforts to comply, but when you ask them to certify that they will comply, then there's something a little unusual about that, and I wondered how you would feel about a very short amendment there to say that a certification of the manufacturer has complied and will make all reasonable efforts to comply with the requirements of.
I think that's okay. Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I think that that's a good way to say it. I was thinking about and intend to continue to comply or something along those lines. Your language, I think, is good.
You're open to that? Senator Ortman moves that on line 4.21. Insert your language, Senator Ortman.
After the word will, delete the word continue and insert instead the words make all reasonable efforts.
Make all or just make reasonable efforts?
Well, I think make reasonable make efforts, reasonable Madam efforts. Chair. Thank you.
On that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 235, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Nope, state and local.
State and local. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Motion Thank passes. You very much.
Senator Betzel.
Two down, four down.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask, and I have no particular, or I have no ulterior motive here, but it's your intention then to limit the discussion in this committee consistently just to those things that apply to judiciary? Because if, well, I'll, no, I don't want to trick you. I happen to think that's a fine approach.
Well, Senator Scheid, yes, in general, yes. And the reason is because we do get a lot of bills coming to us on a re-referral that may be a 30, 40, 50-page bill where only one clause of it has to do with data practices or a penalty or something that has brought that bill to this committee. And, you know, I won't, if the committee, if a certain committee members feel like they want an opportunity to examine a certain area, I won't be mean about not letting that happen. But I do, as our workload continue, I do want to encourage the committee members to focus on the reason why, you know, that bill is being brought to this committee, just out of fairness for the authors.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think particularly because of re-referrals that I think that that's important, actually, though, for all committees, not just this.
Well, we will try to do that in this
Thank
committee,
you. I appreciate
Senator Scheid.
Thank you.
Sometimes we won't succeed.
Uh-oh.
But we will try.
My individual search included as assembly mark. See you on.
Senator Betzel, Senate File 914.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member, Senate File 914 is actually an issue that we've sort of skirted around in the last couple of committee meetings on expungement. You had some similar language in your bill, and Senator Rutman had in her bill, which ultimately were deleted. Well, here's a bill that has it in, and I do have an A1 delete all amendment, and I anticipate that there's still going to be some discussion, but I think that at least the A1 amendment, as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I desire to proceed with, it will at least clarify the issues as we have before us. And
sure.
I'd like to move the A4 amendment. A4 amendment.
It's the A4 amendment, right? Do all the members have the A4 amendment
yes.
in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what we will be working off of. So, on the A4 amendment to put in the shape that the author would desires it to be in, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposing say nay. Motion passes.
And Madam Chair, members, the issue before us is regarding data business screening agencies. It's also been referred to as data harvesting. And let me describe the purpose of the bill before I turn it over to the witnesses for their presentation. Obviously, as we talked about in the expungement bills, there's a lot of information that's being collected on individuals. And, of course, these organizations are collecting it for their business purposes. And then sending it downstream for use by other people, individuals, organizations, whoever feels the need to use it. Obviously, in this information age, there should be a concern that information is being sent out is correct, and if it is not correct, at least there is a means to find out if it's correct, and there is a method to correct it and have some consequences if some organization is sending out information that can be personally damaging to individuals, and the steps are not being taken to correct the information. Let me turn it over, as I say, to the witnesses who can testify a little bit more further on the overall goals and the concepts behind the bill, and then we can go through more detailed discussion of it.
Mr. Sikora, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Robert Sikora with the State Board of Public Defense. John McCullough from the Council on Crime and Justice had an urgent family matter that he had to deal with, and he will try to join us as soon as he can. This committee has spent many hours over the last week struggling with the concepts around expungement. There are two holes in the expungement boat, and you've been working thus far on plugging the Schultz hole. And there's another hole in expungements, and that's created by the data harvesters, because they can grab huge amounts of information and store them on their own computers outside of the control of state law. That creates sort of a parallel universe. And that means then that an individual can pursue an expungement, obtain an expungement, and feel that they have dealt with that problem in their life, only later to discover that a data harvester is disseminating the record that they thought they had expunged. There are two problems that I'd like to highlight to you today. The first has to do with the presumption of innocence, and the second has to do with staleness and inaccuracy of data. Looking at the first problem about how harvested data can undo the presumption of innocence, walk with me for a moment through your experience in the criminal justice system. You're arrested, you're booked, you're charged, you're convicted. At any point, you can have good news. You can be released without booking. You can be released because the prosecutor has decided that they don't wish to charge you. You can be charged but have the charge dismissed, or in a court proceeding, you can be acquitted. Even after conviction, you can be restored by being released from probation and having a judge determine that you're rehabilitated. After any of those moments, an expungement remedy is available to you. But the problem occurs when a data harvest has occurred earlier in time. You could be the name of the charge you were arrested for could be harvested and never updated. You could be booked for something else. That could be harvested and never later updated. The problem exists because all of those data harvests prior to the conviction occur during the time that the Constitution tells us we need to presume the individual innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So the question is, are we talking about a handful of people, or is this an enormous problem? I suggest it's an enormous problem. Looking at Hennepin County and misdemeanor, Hennepin County misdemeanor bookings and Ramsey County misdemeanor bookings, in a study done by the Council on Crime and Justice in 2004, 59% of the bookings, amounting to just under 30,000 people in the calendar year 2004, were released without being convicted. 58% in Ramsey County. So we've looked at the first problem, how the gathering of that data can interfere with an individual's presumption of innocence. It creates collateral consequences for them in the form of lost opportunities for employment and housing. The Supreme Court, in redesigning its rules of public access to records of the judicial branch, struggled with this very same question. it came up with its Rule 8 Subdivision 3, which created focus on the bulk harvesting of court records. The approach that they used was to create a contract between the bulk data harvester and the courts. And Ms. Pontius, in her work on the language of this bill, came up with a slightly cleverer concept, I think, in almost taking the concept of implied consent from DWI law and applying it to this activity, saying that by engaging in the business of data harvesting in Minnesota, you impliedly consent to jurisdiction of the laws of the state. Because there's a problem when the data harvester is in New Jersey or perhaps on a foreign shore. There's a problem in creating the jurisdictional control over that entity. And Ms. Pontius's language in the bill that you're viewing today creates an implied consent. By doing business, you shall be deemed to have consented to the laws of the state of Minnesota. So I think that's done in a slightly more elegant way than the court chose, but the purpose is exactly the same. The second problem has to do with the timing of these data harvests. If the data harvest occurs here early in the process through the criminal justice system, and the expungement occurs later, the expungement can occur at any time. The data harvest, any time early, any earlier in time harvest is going to provide the wrong information to landlords and employers. There currently is no requirement in law that where the state of Minnesota demands that data harvesters update their data to show the most current information held by the government entity. So that's a staleness problem. In addition, there's an accuracy problem. What happens if the overworked clerk sitting in district court banging on the keys of the computer as huge volumes of people come through that courtroom accidentally types the wrong birth date or the wrong middle name? Everybody knows that happens. The court corrects its data when errors are discovered. What happens then if there's a correction later in time but the data harvest has already occurred? Again, there's no law in the state of Minnesota that requires a data harvester to update their records to reflect the most recent information held. John McCullough, I was kind of hoping he'd be sitting here. He worked for the last 2 years on an expungement clinic through the Council on Crime and Justice. He brought the records of his client files with him, and he sat down in our office last December and did searches on the names of people for whom he did a variety of different kinds of expungement. Some of them were dual branch expungements, both the judicial branch and the administrative branch, and we searched for their names. And routinely we came up with stale information, conviction information that had been expunged by government but not by the private data harvester. This is a document that preserves the privacy of the individual involved by blocking out her last name and date of birth of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension letter acknowledging that the expungement has occurred, and the page from Choice Point that reflects 2 months after the expungement the charge that was expunged. In addition to Choice Point, we looked at Westlaw's people search function, and it showed the same information. Now, Mr. McCullough has been doing these expungements for 2 years in the expungement clinic run by the Council on Crime and Justice. We found expungements that occurred 2 years ago that still showed up on Choice Point and Westlaw's display of conviction information. This was on December 19th, around mid-December, that we did all of these searches. So we've talked about these two problems, number one having to do with the presumption of innocence, number two having to do with the data becoming stale, losing the effect of any expungement that's occurred or any corrections that have occurred. And it's your struggle to determine how we deal with those problems while we still keep an open and transparent system and allow a healthy media, healthy news media, to get the information it needs to do its job. We all have taken oaths to support and defend the Constitution, the First Amendment of which becomes relevant in this discussion. I spent 10 years serving on the board of the Civil Liberties Union in Minnesota, and I am acutely aware when issues arise regarding the First Amendment. The bill, I believe, preserves that sense of openness. In other words, anybody can go and get information about what's happened in our judicial system by going to the BCA, by going to the court's information management system, MNSIS, and pulling information. What this does is it prohibits data harvesters who compile the data from selling identifying information about people who have been accused but not convicted. That's the first concept. The second concept is to make sure that the data harvesters have the most fresh and updated information available, and that's the 30-day requirement. I should add, too, that in my experience, I own a small duplex in South Minneapolis, and I use a service called rentalresearch.com. And yes, I run all of my tenants through that search service. I'm aware that it's not perfect. An individual can come back with absolutely zero convictions, and that would create the false impression in the mind of a landlord who doesn't know as much about the system as I do that that person would be a great tenant. I know that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has a pretty extensive list of what they call suspense files, and so it's possible for an individual to actually have a felony conviction but look like they don't have one at all. I'm concerned about that, making decisions based on potentially inaccurate information. Another thing that concerns me as me, the guy who's the most concerned about giving people an even break, imagine there I look at a sheet of paper and one person comes up with no convictions and one person comes up with a conviction. It really challenges me to be able to give them the full benefit of the doubt. I don't know the history. I'm only getting the very tip of the iceberg when I do that sort of search. And if you know, it causes me some pause, but I suspect that routinely what happens is landlords look at that data and they make instant decisions based on the fact that accusations occur. It concerns me greatly in my dozen years representing clients as a public defender in the courtroom when I see the number of times that young black men have been arrested and never charged with anything, so that when their record comes up on their landlord's screening service, they don't stand a chance of getting that apartment. Whereas the young white person, never arrested, they're going to have a much better shot at renting the apartment and at getting a job. It's that sort of disparity that this committee is going to have to wrestle with. It's a balancing act that you do. I'm happy to help you in that balancing act and answering any questions that you have. That's the end of my prepared comments.
Very good. Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I should point out a couple of things in the bill, and it has generated some discussion. Some people have contacted me about issues and concerns, and I'm sure they're going to testify to that. And I think that, you know, we're still going to need to give some consideration to some things, and I'll just start off with one or two things that have come to my attention. In the definition section on page 1, line 5, it tries to define a business screening service means a person engaged in collecting, evaluating, assembling. And I think as Ms. Pontius can explain to us, person is identified in law as quite broadly. It can be a business, corporation. It doesn't have to be an individual person. But that definition, definitions are important because when we get down to lines 111 to 113, this is the requirement that the service must not disclose or disseminate a criminal record for which there has been no conviction, and identifies a person who is subject and identifies the subject of the record. There are some people who are going to have some issues and concerns with this. I think that we have to be aware of the fact that the word person in the definition section could probably be read to include something like the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. which of course is not the purpose of this bill, to because they are the ultimate collectors of it. I'm looking at the people who are collecting government data and sending it downstream. Likewise, a news media organization certainly uses information, but their purpose is much different than those, again, who are harvesting the data mainly to provide it as a source for somebody else, not to report the information as it exists and at the time it exists. So I think, you know, Madam Chair, it's going to I don't quite have the answer there, but I'm just cautioning that I'm aware of some issues that need to be addressed here.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Pondius had highlighted that as an issue, and she has some potential language here. Would you like to hear?
Sure.
Ms. Pondius.
Madam Chair, members, this would just address the government entities like the BCA. It would not address issues like media exceptions or anything, but I think if all you'd have to do is on the amendment on page 1, line 7, after the period, insert business screening service does not include a government entity, comma, as defined in section 13.02. So that would exclude basically all the state and local government entities under the Data Practices Act. Because obviously there are special provisions in Chapter 13 that apply to their data. So.
I'd like to move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel has moved the amendment as read by Ms. Pondius. Any discussions on that amendment? Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, could she reread the thing?
Ms. Pondius, could you repeat the amendment?
Madam Chair, on page 1, line 7 of the A4 amendment, after the period, insert, business screening service does not include a government entity, comma, as defined in section 13.02, period.
Very good.
Very good. On Senator Betzel's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment passes. Now, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill also requires that in lines 1.14 through 16 that a screening service must not disseminate a record of a conviction unless the accuracy has been verified within the past 30 days. And the intent here is the fact that some of these organizations regularly go to the source, the government agency, to get the information. And I think with computers being as they are, I think asking to have them keep their records current, at least during a 30-day cycle, is not unexpected. Now, perhaps that cannot be done. I'll be interested in the testimony on it. But following that, we have a process by which an individual can challenge the accuracy of the records and ask that they be corrected. There's a federal law, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that does provide remedies for individuals for them to correct records. Now, just the fact that you disagree with something doesn't mean that they should correct it. And of course, it does say here, starting at line 1.27, that the business screening service can terminate an investigation of a disputed record if it believes it believes that the dispute is frivolous. The bill as introduced had some hefty remedies, and it had like a $10,000 fine and so forth. I felt that was a bit steep. So this amendment on the back side line, starting on line 2.3, says that a person of a screening service that violates this section could be liable for a penalty of $1,000 or actual damages. So that, and although there's been discussion about employment and housing situations, I don't know that the thrust of this bill is limited to only them. It certainly doesn't say so in here. So the information could be used in various ways. And if somebody has actual damages because of a business screening service putting out wrong information and continuing to put out wrong information, I think that actual damages could be, you know, in excess of $1,000. But if it's de minimis, maybe $1,000 is the right amount. And then finally, there's a section on the service of process and submitting to the jurisdiction of the state for the services, because many of them are not physically located here. That's my overview of the bill, Madam Chair. I'm sure I don't know if anybody else is here to testify in favor of it. I know that there are people who have concerns on it, and I'm certainly willing to stand for any questions.
Are there any more questions to the bill? All right. Senator Higgins and Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, mine's probably pretty easy. On line 2.5, what's the difference between cost and disbursement? It says they pay damages plus costs and disbursements and reasonable attorney fees.
Senator Chair, Betzel.
Yeah, that's in any court proceeding, we used to say that court costs are pretty minimal. I mean, the filing fee, but of course that's been raised considerably, and the actual costs of getting a lawsuit going are not usually pretty great because the government pays for the court services and so forth. But there could be a lot of other expenses incurred in a lawsuit. If you take a deposition, for instance, that can be quite expensive. Witness fees and so forth. And typically, if you happen to go to a lawsuit, a party can petition for the payment of cost and disbursements. The winner can have asked the court to award those to be paid for by the loser. I think that pretty much covers it. I don't know if some of my lawyer colleagues on the committee want to add anything or correct it, but that's. That in a nutshell is what cost and disbursements are.
Madam Chair, is cost and disbursements a thing? Is it not costs and disbursements? It's costs and disbursements.
Yeah, they're two separate items. Costs.
What is?
The costs are usually the court costs, and I say those are usually pretty limited. You know, you have to pay a filing fee to start a lawsuit. Sometimes you have to pay other fees. If you get a subpoena, you know, but disbursements are the ones that are the expenses you usually have to incur, and they call them disbursements at the end. So they're two different categories in legal parlance, but when at the end you ask the court to award you costs and disbursements.
Thank you.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sikora, you posed a number of questions. Do you have any answers to those questions?
Mr. Sikora.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, as far as the balancing act between First Amendment concerns and the sort of damage that we're considering here, when I look at the First Amendment, I see it's not absolute. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater. It's always a balancing act between the harms and the benefits. What I ask this committee to consider is that the damage done to the people of Minnesota by having unregulated data harvesting is very great. Yes, there is an impingement on First Amendment freedoms by government telling a private entity holding information what it can and cannot do with that information. I suggest that the balance tips in favor of protecting the people of the state of Minnesota. It is a balance, and for me, the balance tips in favor of regulating.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, on a different note or a related note, at this time I'd like to offer the A5 amendment, which would include a new paragraph as subdivision 5, providing, and is that being passed out now to members? Thank you. A business screening service that disseminates a criminal record must include the date when the record was collected and a notice that the information may include records that have been expunged, sealed, or otherwise have become inaccessible to the public since that date. And then I believe I'd like to ask Ms. Pontius to explain the significance of the language in this amendment.
Well, Senator Olson, I believe this is an issue that has been brought up. Senator Betzel is aware of this amendment, and it is an attempt to try to address the staleness issue that's in Mr. Sakura's presentation. Okay. Senator Betzel, any response?
Well, Madam Chair, I, as I said, we're going to have some testimony on things, and maybe we can start perhaps with this issue. I observe that this does make it a little bit easier to determine if the records are stale, if the information that's been disseminated, you try to put the markers in time as to what is happening, and this does make it easier for somebody who's seeking relief to help make their case, which may not go well with business screening services, but I don't know from a technology standpoint if they have to do anything in addition. It seems to me that they should be able to, but I'd have to allow the people who have issues or concerns on this to testify on their own behalf. I'm okay with it, but as I say, others may have contrary points of view.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Betzolt, with respect to Subdivision 2 of the bill, Section 1, Subdivision 2, I'm a little surprised at the breadth of that. If I'm understanding what you're saying that
Senator
now...
Senator Ortman, are you going to a different part of the bill?
I'm sorry. I was trying to understand. I thought we were going to take testifiers, and I just wanted to understand the impact and the intent of the bill on Subdivision 2. If you'd like me to wait, I'd be happy to do that.
Can we deal with Senator Olson's amendment?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll come to you.
Thank you.
For that section. Senator Betzel, okay, Senator Olson, do you wish to put this amendment on, and then we'll just hear from the testifiers on the whole bill and your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, at this time I'd like to move the amendment.
Senator Olson has moved the A5 amendment. Any discussion? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, how does this coordinate with Subdivision 3? Subdivision 3 says you can't disseminate a record unless it's accurate within the previous 30 days. And if that's the case, why do you need to include a notice?
Well, I was I guess that thought occurred to me as well, but I'm sure that there would always be a period of time, since you're only going to be updating these records every 30 days, that there may be information within that falls within that window that would no longer be accurate.
Okay, so you think the notice is needed even to govern or even to control the situation where there may be a 30-day window where it could be inaccurate?
That's correct, Senator Neville.
Sorry, Senator Olson. Senator Neville, I also understand that Subdivision 3 only applies to convictions. I guess that's...
That's true.
Senator Neville, I guess there would be a broader array of records that would be subject to this subdivision that would be... that this protection would apply to, or this information would apply to.
Okay.
Senator Olson's amendment, any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Betzel, thank you. We'll have the other testifiers come up to the table.
Okay.
We'll have Mr. Neumeister, Mr. Horner, and Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
Could I ask Senator Betzel the question? I apologize.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Senator Ortman. Senator Betzel, please sit back down. Senator Ortman.
Okay. Oh, sure.
Senator Ortman, you go first.
Thank you. Yeah. Madam Chair, I was trying to get at the new language on Subdivisions 2 and 3 because that's absolutely new. And it was, I commend Senator Betzolt for working on this bill. I just want to make sure everybody understands what I think it says. And maybe, Senator Betzolt, you want to correct me. But I think what you're saying is these screening services now cannot include an arrest or a charge, even if it's accurate. It cannot be included on a business screening service. Or a conviction. I'll just leave it at arrest or a charge. And then Subdivision 3 says that the conviction can't even be on the record, even if it's accurate, unless they've waited 30 days or verified it within that 30-day period. And so I think I'm struck by the breadth of that. Now we've got this notice on here that says that it may not have been the records may have been expunged or sealed since with the amendment from Senator Olson. But I'm trying to understand if I'm reading this right and you're saying that no arrests, no charges, even if they're accurate, can be on here as a result of Subdivision 2, and that Subdivision 3 essentially says they can't even put a criminal conviction on unless they've verified the conviction in some way, which may actually not even be possible. Am I reading the bill right, Senator Betzold?
Madam Chair, Betzold. Yes, Senator Rutman, as we had in the presentation, many times an arrest does not result in a conviction. And so, and again, the information that's being gathered on individuals and sent out saying that so-and-so was arrested for something, and then that's all that is out there. And, in fact, we had an example provided to us where even if the record is expunged, it still tells you that this person was arrested. Well, with the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, collecting databases of persons that's arrested, you know, could cause harm for some individuals' reputations. But if there's a conviction, there should be some attempt to make sure that there's some accuracy that there was actually a conviction, and you could do that, you know, within the day or so, but at least hopefully within some recent time period you verified that the person actually was convicted of the crime, then that certainly would be public information.
Thank you.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I got here late, so if you've covered this already, I'm looking at page 1, line 5, definition of business screening service. I think I heard that you amended that to exclude government entities. Is that the only change that you made?
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, correct.
Well, Senator Betzold, as I look at this definition, it seems like it would apply to newspapers and TVs and radio stations because they disseminate to third parties. Are we trying to say that the media can no longer publicize when somebody's arrested?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States trumps it all because we cannot pass any law abridging the right of freedom of the press. And to the extent that we try to determine what they can and cannot publish, I think would be unconstitutional on the federal level. So I don't think that we can say one way or the other what they can do with their information.
Okay. So,
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, individual people have as much a First Amendment right almost as the media would. What's the distinction?
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, the distinction here, well, first of all, an individual is not necessarily a there is a right to freedom of speech. However, of course, as you're aware, there are limits to freedom of speech. You cannot defame an individual, and you can be consequences for doing that. This basically holds people, these agencies, these organizations who are in the business of collecting data, usually from government, probably all we mean from government here, from these criminal records, and then turning around and distributing, usually selling the raw data to individuals without correcting it and updating it. And to that extent, that is different from just freedom of speech. You are doing so in an irresponsible way if you're putting out information that I think by some checking, you could find out if the information is even correct or not, which is much different from, I think, you know, people saying things on the street which may or may not be true. It differs from the news media reporting information. I think this is the business of gathering and sending out information which, frankly, can be harmful to people's reputations.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Betzold,
Senator Neville,
are you really trying to get at, under the definition of business screening service, people who are in the business or practice for compensation of disseminating?
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, I believe that was who it's mainly going to apply to, but I don't know if some clever organization could kind of find a way to build a firewall between, you know, one entity that, you know, is not for profit or not making, you know, not charging, and then some other the other side of the house that actually is in the process of selling data. So I think trying to get the compensation component of it is, you know, might create more definitional problems. So there are organizations out there that frankly collect and sell this data, and I think those are the ones that I think are the ones that probably the ones that we are interested in.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sakura.
If I can respond also to Senator Neville's concern, I think that if I were to go down to the BCA and gather information for you, I shouldn't be covered by this bill. And when we talk about balancing the harms, it's the bulk data harvesting. It's really the concept of hundreds of thousands of records and the lives of many people being affected. In fact, the court, in its rules, uses the phrase bulk data. We don't use that in this bill, but that truly is the concept behind it.
Madam Chair, just to comment respond to that, if that's what our intent is, we should say it that way. Otherwise, we're creating business for the courts. We can try to enforce the Constitution here, too. We don't have to wait for the courts to narrow it down to whatever level they think is appropriate. So, if we're trying to get at the bulk, collecting and disseminating of it, particularly if it's a business for doing it, we can say that, can't we?
Mrs. Sakura?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, I believe we can, and I think that would be an improvement.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, do you think that that's broad enough to cover what you want? It just seems to me that it's in a better shape now than it will be after we follow your suggested change.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm really just trying to explore the intent right now of the author of the bill. But I think as I look at the definition now, the words of that apply to the media. And so the media will immediately challenge it. And so do we want to just take the media out? Well, once we take the media out, who else should we take out? Because, I mean, we should figure out who we really intend to target with this so that at least if there's going to be a court challenge, and there may be, at least we've crafted the who we're really trying to go at in terms of the balancing test. Apparently we're not intending to prevent the TV from issuing or from reporting that so-and-so was arrested.
Senator Ortman.
And Madam Chair, following up on that, if that's the case, then we're essentially putting these business screening services out of business because it is the whole purpose of the business to report the information that's available about arrests and charges that are of a public nature. Now that information is going to be in the newspaper, it's going to be on TV, but it can't be on the screening service. So what is the value of the screening service? Because anybody that's interested in that information is going to have to go elsewhere anyway. And so then they're not saying that they're complete. They don't even have all the information that's true and in the public domain. And so I think that's a problem.
Can I ask one more
question?
Senator
Neville.
Maybe let me play devil's advocate with either witness, Senator Betzel or the witness. In this day and age of Google, if it's in a newspaper or if it's basically disseminated by any media,
it's gone.
Why can't they just type the person's name on Google? And they'll be able to use that, apparently, no matter what we say in this bill.
There's no way to stop that.
I guess the question is, once the genie is out of the bottle, once the information is public, how can you put it back in?
Well,
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, first of all, I don't think that we should trust everything we read on the Internet. There have been known to be some erroneous information, so let the buyer beware if that's how you're – if you're doing your term paper over the Internet, you may have some problems. I think that but to the extent that, again, you know, professional services are being offered, there should be some accuracy, some trust in them, information is going to be spread out there. Once you open the pill and the feathers go out, it's awfully hard to put them back in the pillowcase.
But, you know, Senator Betzel and Senator Neville, Senator Betzel makes a good point that while it may not be the intention of this bill to prevent the media from reporting, I think that all individuals who have that reporting opportunity does have an obligation to fact check. And I think the public, that's something that I hear all the time. It's not that we don't want them to exercise their First Amendment right to report information that's out there. But I think that in general, we would want them to do some fact-checking to make sure that what they're reporting and disseminating is accurate.
Madam Chair.
Mrs. Sakura.
To respond to both Senator Neville and Senator Ortman, if this bill were to become law tomorrow, the business screening services would be providing information on convictions, and the customers of those services would have the assurance that it was verified as accurate within 30 days. So that would actually enhance the saleability and the usefulness of that data. And as far as Senator Neville's comment about Google, I think, again, we aren't looking at that sort of ad hoc snoopery, if I can use that word. We're looking at transactions that really amount to hundreds of thousands and millions of records being transferred, which is a very clear moment in the business practice of a company that engages in this kind of work.
Thank you. All right, Senator Higgins, then I want the other people to be able to come and testify. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, in my other job, I spend a fair amount of time on Google and a lot of other databases trying to find owners of buildings and various things. And I know that sometimes I can pull up like a small-town newspaper that has their police blotter information. You know, Joe Blow got arrested for a DWI and he was a .13 and, you know, whatever all. But I guess I don't know very much about these data harvesters. Do they just get the information from the courts and that kind of information, and they wouldn't like Google and find out what other information is available? You know, I guess I'm just asking really, what kind of data do they provide and say that they've done a thorough job?
Mrs. Secor?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, in my experience with Mr. McCullough, when we were searching the Choice Point and Westlaw records, it appeared to me that 100% of the records we looked at were identical to those provided by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Actually, it was the project had two purposes, because I was determining whether or not it would be of use for the Board of Public Defense to get information from these services. Mm-hmm. But we already obtain information from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension at no cost, so it appeared to be an exact copy of that BCA record. I didn't see, and it doesn't mean that they don't do it, and I just never searched a record that it would indicate that. I didn't see anything other than what appeared to be a bulk download of data from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Although, Madam Chair and Senator
Betzel.
Higgins, I think some of the organizations that may be affected by this do get information from other sources, such as the news media, so I don't know that it is exclusive to court records, but I'll let the organization of issues testify to that.
Thank you. Well, Senator Higgins, just for your own curiosity, maybe the better question to ask is, how many of our agencies and local and governmental entities sell public records in bulk to some of these, you know, harvesters? So, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Sakura, going back to the distinction again between Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 3, and I guess I would echo the concern that if you're telling someone that they cannot disclose criminal records for which there is no conviction, and as broad as that is, and I guess that issue has been raised, that would mean that we're telling them that even if they get this information from the internet or anywhere, however they may have this information or have obtained this information, that they cannot then disclose or further disseminate that information. And I just have real strong doubts about the First Amendment, whether that would pass a challenge under the First Amendment. That being said, Subdivision 3, when it talks about disseminating records unless the accuracy has been checked, is really, in my mind, a separate issue. One is saying what can be disclosed. The other is talking about how accurate the information has to be. I'm going to ask you, I guess, whether you feel that if we were to say a business screening service must not disseminate a record of, or just say a must not disseminate a criminal record unless the accuracy of the record has been verified, You're still left with subdivision 2, which is that separate issue of whether we can do that or not. But if for some reason that subdivision were struck down, then we would still have a requirement that the accuracy of these things, of all records, have to be checked within within 30 days if they're going to be disseminated.
Mr. Sakura or Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, subdivision 2 duplicates what the Minnesota Supreme Court has done with its own records. Now, by doing that in its Rule 8 of the rules of public access to records of the judicial branch, it specifically references the bulk data that is obtained from the government entity, in that case, the courts. So what they're doing is restraining not local newspaper searches by the data harvester. They're restraining how their data are used downstream in the stream of commerce. So I'd have to have some time, I guess, to make sure that the language that we have before us does exactly what the Supreme Court is doing, rather than saying we're trying to control anything you do, any Google search you do, any newspaper you search. Our intention is to say we would like to control the downstream use of our data. There are some very basic principles called the Fair Information Practice Principles that are the basis of every government policy about handling information. And a core concept in the Fair Information Practices is that you are responsible for the downstream use of your data. That's our intent, to control how our data is used downstream, not to control other data that they may accumulate.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Mr. Sakura, on Rule 8, that's what the Supreme Court is saying they're going to allow the access to. They're only going to allow access to the conviction data and not the pre-conviction data. But what we're dealing with is the business screening services that have access to the BCA, which includes truthful and accurate arrest records. It also includes charges. And there might also be information in the media that's available as well. And so I think you're trying to use a dissemination rule against a gathering organization. And I'm not sure that it applies directly. I can see the purpose of limiting the information we're providing, but I think now you're talking about a private entity, and we can't limit what they are trying to do. You can have an internal rule, but what we're going to share. But I don't think that under the First Amendment we have the right to limit what other people can say, especially when it's truthful and accurate.
Mr. Sakura.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, to correct you, the rule that the Supreme Court promulgated does allow full disclosure of information, of all pre-conviction information. It simply says, for those pre-conviction records, you may not re-disseminate downstream identifying information about those individuals.
Okay.
That was the first point that you made. And I've lost the second point. I'm sorry.
Me too.
Senator Foley, then I want to bring the other testifiers up so that we can continue to have the discussion. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, that's what I'm asking you to do, is to take the con folks and hear what they have to say.
Thank you, Senator Foley.
Yes.
Mr. Neumeister, Mr. Horner, Mr. Tennyson, please, all of you, come on up.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Neumeister. My point of view on this bill is I'm positive about the bill. I may take a different kind of approach, but you got to look at what the reality is now, is that we are about on the verge, whether it's current law or the bill that passed this committee yesterday, of either expanding expungements to convictions or we're trying to deal with a current problem now. The current problem is that people are getting expungements, and if people just use BCA data, They apply for, let's say, a statutory check background or someone that relies a lot on BCA data, they're more than likely going to get the housing, their reputation's still going to be saved, or whatever it might be. But in the private sector, you've got a lot of entities who do a lot of things, and a lot of people go to them. So that's the issue I think this bill is trying to correct. Now, the help solve where we can do something this year in the private sector, I'd like to start out with the following. The only states that have addressed this issue, and they're in terms of different approaches, are at least about four or five. California is one of them, and I shared that piece of data with you last week, and I gave a copy to your council. Secondly, the state of Texas has answered that, and what they have defined there, these entities, these business services, are as follows. And I've also given a copy of both those laws that have passed in 203 and 205 to your council. The definition is a private entity that compiles and disseminates for compensation criminal history record information may not compile or disseminate information with respect to which an order of non-disclosure, which is basically their expungement, how they call it. So that even there helps with the definition to help define a little bit so you can get out of how broad, how this or that is. So I would suggest that item. One of the other things that is going to come out, and being as around here a long time, I've heard, well, the federal government preempts these things or whatever. Now, I've had experience where I've done a lot of in-depth research, and I find out the argument, oh, the federal government preempts it. Not true. But then there are some areas where I might say maybe there is a preemption argument here. FACTA, which is the Fair Credit Reporting Act amendments, which happened in 2004, which allow us to get free credit reports and still get $3 credit reports and with our laws and stuff, may have an impact on this. But the law allows, though, the federal law allows for states. FACTA does not preempt other state laws or laws that take different approaches to remedying the same problem. So the issue is, and I'm sure some of the other testifiers, at least I know one testifier may bring that up. So the issue is there might just need to be some kind of research on that. But also, you also need to be aware there are a number of agencies that FCRA does not cover at all. And that's where we have seen sometimes state laws covering some entities and FCRA and all those kinds of things. So in summary, it's important that we continue on with the discussion. And I think something needs to be passed to deal with an important issue that's hurting people now in areas of reputation, livelihoods, and I call the old thing personal autonomy. Particularly with old arrest records, old petty misdemeanors, you know, kind of offenses that we've heard from people. So take a look at qualifying the definition. Number two, take a look at some research with some other states are done. And three, I encourage to push on. The other thing I forgot about was Nevada. Nevada, and again, I gave counsel a copy of that law, is where you can serve expungement orders on private entities, which is kind of unusual. But they've been doing pretty well with it. I think it's a law. It's been around for at least a half a decade, maybe longer. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm with the law firm of Great Plains Moody. And I also represent Reed Elsevier with the parent company of LexisNexis, which is a business information service provider. I want to make a couple of comments. First of all, as Mr. Sikora said, there's a parallel universe. There is. It's called the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And Mr. Neumeister mentioned the need to review that, and you do, because there are certain preemptions, and this act hasn't been reviewed carefully in that regard. And I can give you some sections that you might want to look at to do that. The Fair Credit Reporting Act does cover housing, employment, credit, and insurance. And the possibility is that you're passing a law that may have already been preempted. So you should really look at that. Secondly,
I don't know about the First Amendment argument about, or the argument about presumption of innocence. I think that's a stretch. There is a presumption of innocence in the court before conviction, but there's people are reported to be arrested or accused a lot of times. John Gotti was arrested and acquitted a number of times. You know, we can carry this to some rather strange extremes. The other thing is the purpose of this bill, as I understand it, and the other bills, was because we've created a monster with our draconian criminal laws over the last 30 years, and we now have 9,000 people in prison instead of 1,800 we had 25 years ago. And now the pressure is pushing out, and we're trying to deal with the problem by dealing with some of the symptoms of it, and I don't think you're going to solve the problem that way. I recognize the need, and certainly the human need, and the ways to try and help people get employment and housing, because without that, it's really pretty drastic. And I see those people without housing every morning when I go to my office. They're in the crystal court of the IDS building because they come off the street to warm up. And they sit there, and they do, and they're well-behaved and all that. But that's where they're coming from. They're coming off the streets and out of the shelters to get warmed up because they don't have housing. And I understand that. And we all understand that. But the purpose of the bill was those two reasons, I thought. And the Fair Credit Reporting Act addresses that quite seriously. So I think you really ought to look at that before you pass this bill. Secondly, I want to draw your attention, and Senator Ortman and Senator Higgins have already touched on some of these issues. I want to draw your attention to Subdivision 2 in Section 1. Subdivision 2. If you read that literally, we couldn't disclose any criminal record as defined there until after a conviction. We couldn't have reported an arrest. We couldn't have reported a charge. We couldn't report the court docket. We would be prohibited from doing that. And at that point, you have secret courts. You can't even find out who's been arrested. You know, there's a logical conclusion of that we're going to have secret trials as well because we don't want anybody to know about what's going on. We've been through the history of the world. We've been through that. It's called the Star Chamber in England, and that's what the public record, public trials is all about. So I think there's some serious language problems here that need to be addressed. I have some suggestions, but I don't think the time is, and we have some language suggestions. I don't think this is particular time. In terms of the other comment we made about the fair information practice principle requiring, the deliverer of the information to be responsible for downstream use, that's just not accurate. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the holder of the information is charged with the responsibility to make sure the information is accurate. We make the information available. It's accurate. If it's changed, we change it. But we have, my client has 40,000, they advertise 40,000 sources of information in our database. 40,000. A small part of that goes to the question of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. We deal with the housing and all that. Many of our customers, our clients across the country, are law enforcement. Many of them in Minnesota are law enforcement. They obtain information from us on arrest records, not only in Minnesota but nationally. You can find people that way. Senator Higgins and I was talking about finding people who are absolute landlords. You know, we provide that kind of service, you know, and a connection with it in an association. So that information, you know, you know, it becomes more accurate as more information you have. And so my suggestion is that you deal with the definition of a business screening service, because under that, anybody's a news media. I remember once sitting on the other side and questioning Don, or guy from CCO, about who's in the media. And you know, I suggest to them that anybody had a pencil is a newspaper person. They are. Anybody has a right to First Amendment privileges under that. And certainly, if somebody sits and runs a blog and picks all the criminal record information off the court docket and publishes it, what are you going to do about that? What if they sell it? What are you going to do about that? So I think there's some serious problems with the bill that could be fixed somewhat. But I think there's some serious other First Amendment problems with it that you probably can't fix. And if you're going to say that throw the First definition of business screening service open to the courts to determine who's a reporter and who's not, why would you do that? Why not solve an issue if you can? I'm not sure you can't, but anyway, so at this point, we oppose the bill as it is. Thank you.
Mr. Tennyson, can you, I don't mean to pick on your client, but how often do they update their information?
Well, we suggest that we update it as it becomes available. You know, when the courts make it available, it's updated. You know, and I don't know how often the court makes it available, but that's what we would have a suggestion that the...
Mr. Tennyson, how do you know when it becomes available?
Well, you get the information from your sources. If the court has, you know, I don't know how often the court, I personally don't know how often the court updates its data. Do they do it daily? Do they do it weekly? I don't know. And I assume we get a data dump as it occurs, because it doesn't help us to have outdated information or incomplete information. I mean, if we have inaccurate information, incomplete information, it's going to hurt our business.
In the previous testifier who presented the information, is that with respect to a certain provider of information where they went in with the example and they got outdated? Is that your client or not?
No, it's not. No, Madam Chair, it was not. I can't guarantee that that never happens. I just don't know. I mean, I just can't guarantee anything like that. All I can say is we do. These are the practices. This is what we try to do. Are there going to be errors? Of course there are going to be errors.
Mm. I mean, I just remember being a law student, really appreciating the devices, whether they're called shepherdizing or whatever the other devices, where you can go in and, you know, just as you are doing cases, you need to have the most updated and the best information. And I'm a little bit surprised that that's not something the technology would be there somehow to do something like this, to quickly update the information.
Well, yeah. Madam Chair, if I may, we have historical data, too. You know, and you have a sequence of things that have happened to that person or whatever, and that's all accurate information. You know, you had the arrest, the charge, maybe the acquittal. You have all that. you may have an expungement, so then you get that. And that's what we deal with, sealing, whatever. But it doesn't mean that the information is inaccurate. If it is expungement, and law enforcement, for example, is one of our customers, is searching for arrest records they're going to go back and find that information. They want that information. It's used for a lot of reasons, not just law enforcement, but also for fraud prevention, fraud detection, and other things. We have information that's used to find missing children or to find unregistered or improperly registered sex offenders. We had a case not too long ago in Florida where there was a person, young child from the school, abducted. And you know, the first thing he looks at all the sex offenders and see where they are, and they find out if there's anything associated with that area. And they found the sex offender in another county whose sister owned a house across the street. They were able to make the connection quickly and solve the problem.
Thank you. You
know, there's a lot of benefit that you need to look at, please. I'm kind of torn on this because I understand the personal trauma and the tragedy that's occurring to the people who are, you know, improperly arrested and all that. And the consequence of these, you know, 30 years of bad criminal laws.
Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack Horner, representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Also with me is Carol Buca, who's the president of Tenant Check, a highly regarded tenant screening company headquartered in St. Paul, who has a couple comments and also can answer questions specifically about her business and how it operates, if the committee members wish. Just a couple of points, Madam Chair. First of all, we have always supported the concept of accurate information, updating information. You've heard reference to the Fair Credit Reporting Act and also Chapter 504B of Minnesota statutes, the landlord-tenant statute, which regulates tenant screening companies, companies that specifically do tenant application checking, requires re-verification of data upon request of the subject, allows the subject to put in his own response. certainly no one wants any inaccurate data, and someone who believes he was arrested unfairly or inaccurately can require that that be checked and put his own statement in. As I testified previously, and not to belabor it, landlords depend on tenant screening companies for a wealth of information, including the kind of behavioral information that they are held responsible for. Police who work with the landlords in the and do wonderful work in the crime-free multi-housing program in the cities that say you should be screening. How else are you going to find out about the kind of unfortunate in some respects, but kind of revolving system that in some cases emerges whereby you have a cycle of arrests and releases and arrests and releases. I mean, unfortunately, it's a big part of our criminal justice system. I want to finally just talk specifically about subdivision 2. That's the issue that, to me, is the one that sticks out as a very serious problem. It says you can never, ever, under any circumstances, give any information other than convictions, even if you're within a time period prior to an expungement of an arrest, even if you're in an area that is permissible, dismissals, or in an area where I'm mentally blocking. Why any of the number of pre-conviction and pre diversion projects before they've ended, where you certainly could, under many schemes of expungements and sealings, give the information, a tenant screening company would be prohibited from doing that. Our point, I think, is that it's very premature to adopt this subdivision. Senator Moy's bill calling for expungements in a scheme of various time periods of various kinds of actions is going to be studied. Her bill will result in a study and coming up with some recommendations. This bill jumps the gun, in our view, and just across the board says, regardless of what any other study or recommendation might be, we can never do anything more than convictions. Finally, I just don't see how this does not raise huge First Amendment issues. I mean, we're not talking about information here that's defamatory or pornographic or fraudulent or inciting to riot or any of the other reasons why language might rightfully be regulated. We're talking here about a huge segment of the criminal justice system, of a vast part of the criminal justice system that now in part will be shielded from view, will make a step further toward a secret kind of activities that is not good for anybody. It's been alluded that people will need the information and try to get it. A bill like this, our fear is that it forces people to try to get the information from untrustworthy sources. And so you might, I think it's better for everybody, and even for the subject of the data, that the information be obtained from a company that's required by law to be accurate and to re-verify information than to simply force people to try to find out in unreliable ways what's the real skinny on this person, what's the real record on this person. The sheet comes back blank, but obviously I don't trust that. So what really is this guy's record? I think that this bill contains a lot of mischief in it, particularly Subdivision 2, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. And Ms. Buka, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. By the way, I operate in St. Paul in your district. And
good to have you here.
Thank you. I have a problem with the definition, and it's been explained that their major concern is with the data aggregators, but I certainly read that definition and saw myself in there as a business that disseminates information. We collect it from the courts. I just wanted to mention a little bit about the specific definitions within the industry, and I'm a member of the National Association of Professional Background Screeners, who has been working very hard in the 4 years since they've been established to try to write white papers and best practices, and one of those best practices is definitely to verify information from a source that's not other than the original source of the information, I guess, is how we there are database searches, and then there are court in-person county searches, and that's the place at which the record resides, the original record resides, all of the changes that might occur are at those county courts. Currently, that is the only kind of criminal search I will provide for my clients. I am, however, severely limited in my ability to compete with other companies because I refuse to sell a search through a national database company because of, currently right now, my main concern is that they're not complete records. The BCA is certainly not a complete record. I prefer to go to those counties, and that's the terminology we use is in-person county searches versus a database search. And I think there's an enormous public perception that this information is easily accessible on the Internet. I did have a client go on to Net Detective or one of those types of websites and tell me that they actually noticed in the fine print that there is a statement on there that says it's not legal to use that site under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. It is not legal to use that site in employment decisions or housing decisions. So you're also forcing potential users of this information even more to the dark side, to that somewhat unreliable or possibly unreliable information that's available on the Internet. And for me to have to tell a client that I can't provide certain information because the state of Minnesota passed a law saying I can't provide it, and yet they can read it in the newspaper or on the web, is I might as well close my doors. And I think you will be much better served by having professional agencies that do this kind of work, that understand all the computer systems at the various court levels. A misread on records by someone who doesn't understand and doesn't go to those courts every day or even use whatever source every day is highly potential because of the problems mentioned earlier with potentially misspelled names or dates of birth that aren't completely accurate. And we always verify information that we receive from those sources. And if I screen someone, the same person, within a week, I still go back to that county and verify that information again. I don't rely on the information I got a week ago. However, on the national side, on those national databases, and in credit reporting, 30 days is not really an adequate time frame to have that correction go through the process. It's generally more like 60 days that updated information is put up. Placed on credit reports. So,
thank you for presenting us the information from the other side. And you sound like you're not the kind of person this bill is meant to talk
about.
But so,
thank you. That definition says me.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Oh, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question of the witness. Occasionally, cities or police departments will collect data which they call incident reports. That's maybe a loud party or something going on in a rental building. And in that incident report, a continual, constant, repetitive incident reports may name the same person over and over and over again, which may lend a future landlord some indication if past behavior predicts future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It may give them a little insight of what kind of tenant that person may be. Would this bill bar you from passing that information?
Specifically.
And it is a public document,
right?
A public record.
But subdivision 3 clearly states that unless there's a criminal conviction, or is it two? I'm sorry. You can't identify the individual who's the subject of the record. Well, that's exactly what I do. And yes, the benchmark within the cities and the ordinances that are passed in the cities to try to control bad behavior, the benchmark used is police calls to the property. That's not an arrest. That's not a charge. That's not a conviction. And that information is definitely being used by landlords. It's being disseminated by the police departments who work with the various landlord groups within various cities. Oftentimes, not in Hennepin and Ramsey or in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but some of the smaller cities, the police officers will bring that information right to their monthly landlord association meetings and provide it free of charge. And I can't provide that very efficiently or very cheaply, but...
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, sometimes those incident reports sometimes splash negatively against a landlord. especially in certain cities of the first class in Minnesota. If a landlord, because then it's perceived mm-hmm. that the landlord is allowing
yes.
that negative antisocial behavior, and somehow, even though the landlord may be not living close to that building where his business is, the apartment building, he could be fined, penalized. Certain cities have even gone to the point of buying out and condemning the property mm-hmm. and then giving a bargain basement minimum price back to the landlord and then taking the property because there's a constant incident that occurs, but no convictions. Unless, of course, you count the landlord as the convicted party. Would that bar anything from that enforcement to happen? Would this bill bar that type of information if you were focused on the landlord?
Mr. Horner?
Madam Chair, Senator Limber, it certainly seems to me that it would. That it's information that is publicly available, and yet a tenant screening company would not be permitted to give it to a landlord who is checking out an application.
So, Madam Chair, if there was a problem property, let's say a problem landlord that didn't seem to enforce leases, they could in fact not be revealed, and then. Maybe I'm parsing this a little differently, but I think you want, if you have a bad landlord, you want to, the city and others want to get after that and correct that behavior as well.
Senator Schott.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that an incident report is covered here. It's not mentioned under criminal record. That talks about arrest, citation, prosecution, criminal proceeding, or conviction. I don't think an incident report is any of those things, so I don't think that that would be covered. So I don't think that the situation that Senator Limmer is discussing is affected by this bill.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, the committee will recall that there was a business screening section of my bill before we took it out. And the purpose of it in my bill was to make sure that if the court granted an expungement order, that the business screening services had an obligation then also to expunge that information that was ordered to be sealed from their records. And that if they failed to do that, then the subject of the order could come back with some kind of civil proceeding to force them to take it off and to recover whatever damages or penalties there might be. I think that's essential, and I hope that this committee will do that with this bill. But I think that Subdivision 2 goes well beyond what we should be doing at this point, limiting these business screening services from disseminating truthful and otherwise accurate information. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would move to amend the A4 amendment to take out Subdivision 2 and renumber the subsequent or the following paragraphs.
Senator Betzel, on Senator Ortman's amendment. Are there any further questions for the witnesses? Can you all just hang out? And if somebody have a question for you, we'll come back to you. That way we can have.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I was thinking kind of along the same lines, and I know you've got a motion pending. I also had asked Senate counsel, and I had given her a way to kind of pull Section 2 and 3 together so that we're not talking about not disclosing not disclosing anything on their conviction. I think what we're trying to do is have accurate information, and I don't know if counsel may have had a chance to look at it, but to the extent that we can have this pulled together to reflect that, I think that I heard part of your motion, but maybe we can hear what counsel has, and maybe that accomplishes the same thing you're trying to get to.
Ms. Pondius.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think the only other change would be also on line 15 to delete record of a criminal conviction and insert criminal record. Otherwise, it would do the same thing, basically delete subdivision 2 and then expand subdivision 3 to include all criminal records instead of limited to convictions.
So and obviously change the head note on line 14, I would guess.
Senator Ormond, will you incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And, Madam Chair, I would ask Senator Ortman to consider whether she would incorporate into her amendment changing 30 days to 60 days.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
With respect, Senator Olson, I hope that we can deal with Subdivision 3 separately, because I was actually going to propose a change that you might like with respect to Subdivision 3, and so I would ask you if you would defer and have a conversation separately about that once we've removed Subdivision 2.
All right. Senator, we'll take that as a separate amendment if you want to offer that. Senator Ortman moves that lines 1.11 through 1.13 be deleted, and at line 1.15, delete after A, insert criminal, and delete of a criminal.
Conviction.
Does everybody understand the amendment?
How would it read, Madam Chair? Could you read the whole sentence starting on 1.4?
Ms. Pontius, can you read the whole sentence?
Madam Chair, it would read, a business screening service must not disseminate a criminal record unless.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
And then you'd also want to delete conviction on like line 14 in the head note.
I'm fine with that, Madam Chair.
Any questions to Senator Ormond on that amendment? On the Ormond amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposing say nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Ormond.
Madam Chair, I would defer to Senator Olson at this time.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, in light of the testimony that we've heard, I would move to amend then Subdivision 3, which I'm assuming then would be now renumbered as Subdivision 2, to omit on line 1.16 to omit 30 days and insert 20 day or 60 days, excuse me, insert 60 days.
Any discussions on Senator Olson's amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I'm advised that the nationwide standard is 30 days. This is not an unusual standard.
Any further discussions on Senator Olson's amendment of changing the 30 days to 60 days? Senator Ormond.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked to defer is that I'm wondering if we want to put what we're trying to do, I think, with Subdivision 3 is hold the business screening services from reporting truthful and accurate information until they've verified that information. And I'm wondering if that is Senator Olson's intent here.
Senator Olson.
Actually, Madam Chair, I think, and Senator Ortman, my intent here, I think that's another important issue, but my intent here was to make sure that this information, if it's going to be disseminated, has been checked for accuracy within a reasonable period of time so that it isn't old, stale information that's being disseminated. And I just wanted to make certain that we're giving a reasonable opportunity to those gathering this information. Because I actually don't know how long it takes for the courts to get this information out into these services that they're obtaining their data from. And I guess I was just taking the word of the previous testifier that it isn't always available and that 60 days was a more reasonable standard.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
And I'm wondering if we accomplish the same goal just by saying that the criminal record must be verified. I mean, if you just take out the language within the previous X number of days, now you're saying that you can't report it unless you've verified it. Whether it's 10 days, 20 days, 50 days, or 150 days, you may not report it unless you've independently verified it. I think that might read better than trying to put in the number of days, Senator Olson.
Senator Ortman, why don't we take Senator Olson's amendment first, and then depending on what happens, the number of days will still be there, and we can come to you for what you want to do, all right? Senator Olson, I have to tell you that the 60, if you want to give them a reasonable amount of time, if they do it every 30 days, they'll just have to do it twice in 60 days. I think that if you're concerned about staleness and accuracy, that every 30 days catches that better than every 60 days where there's a broader gap.
Okay. Madam Chair, then I'll withdraw my amendment. I guess another just a suggestion for discussion might be, and I don't really want to put this in the form of an amendment at this point, but just to address both of our concerns, I wonder if we looked at language that said something like has been verified with the most recent information reasonably available or something along those lines. If that would, I don't know if that would address the issue or what anyone else
Senator
thinks
Olson
about that.
Senator Olson has withdrawn her amendment. Now, I'm sorry. Please repeat what you wanted to do with it.
Well, I'm just suggesting for discussion if we said something like has been verified with the most recent information reasonably available, whether that would address both the concern that Senator Ortman raised and the concern that I had.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, there might be another way to get at this, and it might be with a sentence that says something along the lines of a business screening service must refresh its bulk data every 30 days or something.
I might not be able to do that, though.
Well, members, why don't you think about this? Because we have someone in the audience who's asked to testify. He's concerned that while we're doing amendments, we're changing the nature of the bill, and he has some information he'd like to share with the committee. This is somebody who hadn't communicated to us before. We didn't know that he wanted to testify. I'm really glad that he came forward and asked for the opportunity. Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Undlin. I apologize for being a day late and a dollar short. I literally came in just to listen and learn a little bit for other reasons that are unfortunately associated with the very bill that you talked about here. And as the amendments kept rolling forward, it seemed to me that the very nature of the original language is being stripped away pretty harshly. Somebody mentioned that this bill has serious problems associated with limiting the information available to only criminal conviction records as opposed to everything antecedent to that. I think there's serious problems because there's a serious problem with making that information available. For the first time in my life, on June 9th of last year, I was arrested. And I can only speak from one vignette as opposed to lots and lots of data. The weight of the arrest hung over my head from June 9th until January 16th. I went through many attempts by the court to move me into a diversion program or to plead out to all kinds of other deals, all the way down to a continuance without a plea and a $50 fine. I was arrested in a hospital emergency room. I was in my hospital shirt. I had my hospital band on. I had just been wheeled off of the locked mental health unit by security, who were called, instead of the nurses, allowing me to talk to a supervisor per patient bill of rights. So when the hospital decided to ignore the patient bill of rights and kick me to the curb, which was their intention, because I had rolled into a state of virtual non-responsiveness, non-talking, think of a turtle pulling itself into a shell to protect itself from what in the heck is going on here. So I didn't get out of the wheelchair when they brought me to the street, quote, off property. And they didn't know what to do. They decided maybe we shouldn't just lay him on the ground, which is what I would have allowed them to do in the state that I was in. So they brought me into the ER. The ER didn't order a psych eval. The ER did not readmit me. The ER didn't contact the unit to have my wife called. The ER, through discussion, someone happened to say, well, maybe we should call the police. That's what they did. So I was arrested for trespassing. And I know that there are databases with first order information about my arrest. And I know that at some point when I get healthy enough to not have certain kinds of bad days, I'll be back out in the marketplace looking for work again. I'm going to have to overcome the onus of 4+, 5+, however long it takes, years of no record of employment because of the mental illness issues. The additional burden of somebody doing a background check and seeing my arrest record scares me. Under the rubric of innocent until proven guilty, for all of the reasons that everybody just told you they want that data, they shouldn't have it. I didn't trespass. After all of these offers that I had to, with great pressure from family and from my therapist, to just cave in and not fight it by saying no, 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 just get it behind you. Take the pressure off yourself. You've laid on the floor too many times. I kept saying no because I knew I didn't trespass. I looked up the law. I read what it required. The officer did virtually no investigation to determine whether or not I had a reasonable right to be there. The hospital called. He said, Mike, I need you to get up. I was non-responsive to the officer. I was non-responsive when he stuck his knuckle in my ear twice to get me to talk. I was non-responsive while he handcuffed me and carried me out. So I have this arrest record that was inaccurate at the time it was created. Everybody's talking about we want accurate records. I probably couldn't even come close to determining how many times a, quote, accurate arrest record, yes, the officer said I was arrested, but it was inaccurate at the time that he created it because he should have turned it back over to the hospital and said, this is not my job here. This is between you.
Mr. Arnlin?
Yeah.
I want to thank you for your testimony on the arrest record and the consequences it's given to you. I don't mean to cut you off.
I understand.
But we have two more bills.
Sure.
And I would really like to get us all out of here.
Can I make one additional point?
Please.
The one additional point is that much of my jail data, because I ended up in jail for a day, okay, is classified as private data. In other words, the media doesn't get it. Nobody else gets it. I'm sure there's a million reasons. I'm not schooled in the law. I'm schooled in the law since June 9th. and it is not a pretty picture. But I'm having a hard time understanding why my record prior to conviction can't all be considered private data. It's nobody else's business because it may have not happened. So it's private data. It seems to me that the very definition, criminal record, should only be conviction. Everything else is some other kind of record. I'm not a criminal when I'm arrested, but that's what the assumption is. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak on an ad hoc, unexpected basis.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your information. All right, members. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I think there was a brief discussion about line 1.16 within 30 days, and Senator Olson had an amendment which she withdrew. I thought Senator Ortman had some issues or concerns. I don't know if those have been resolved.
I'd offer that.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure where we left off on Subdivision 3, and so I'm wondering if Council, because we were in the middle of that, if Council might be able to just advise us of what the current status is of Subdivision 3.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, Subdivision 3 now reads, it became Subdivision 2. Subdivision 2 is gone, and it just reads, it's criminal records, and it states that a business screening service must not disseminate a criminal record unless... And then the rest of the language has not been changed yet. Senator Olson did have the amendment to change the 30 to 60, withdrew it, and that's kind of where the discussion left off.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, if I could recommend to the committee that we just end the sentence at after the word verified and put in a period, because they're all different. Business screening services have different processes by which they update and verify their information and time periods within which they do that. And so we may just, if we want them to verify these records, let's just say they may not publish them until they've been verified. I think it may be a simpler approach to that issue.
Well, Senator Betzel. Well,
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I think that that does go contrary to the purpose of the bill, that is to have a requirement that if information is changed, it be updated. A better approach, if the committee is not satisfied with the 30-day requirement, to at least require that it be verified as the information is made available, so that if there is new information, it be updated. So I don't think just putting the period after verified, I think that causes more damage, but at least to have some requirement that the updates be incorporated, I think is quite important here.
On this amendment,
I don't...
Senator Schott.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman wanted to share something with someone outside. Here she comes.
Well, Senator Ortman, Senator you didn't Betzel hear says, Senator Betzel's response to you. So
I'm sorry. I apologize to the committee.
Sure. The purpose of the bill is to make sure that if there's new information, that it be updated. And rather than putting a period after verified and striking the rest of the sentence, I would suggest at least having that it be verified as the information is made available, so that there is still a requirement to update the information, rather than just leaving it hang there.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, is the issue verified or updated? Senator Betzel.
I think that, well, both. I mean, it should be verified and it should be updated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
How about this as a compromise? Delete within the previous 30 days and say within 7 days of dissemination. So they can take as long as they want.
Does that work?
When the order is placed for the data, maybe they take 60 days like Senator Olson wants.
Maybe to clarify.
But they have to verify it within a certain period of time from the time they release it. Would that be a middle ground that works?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel. Neville, I think you'd have to say within 7 days by dissemination of the originating agency, so we know whose
correct
data we're
yes
talking about.
That's the intent. By the business screening service, within 7 days of
right
dissemination by the business screening service.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
And Madam Chair, I think, and if you say as the info is or information is made available, it may be available this morning, and you disseminate it this afternoon. I mean, so I think you. That's problematic as well. So I like what Senator Neville is saying.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I've been in and out a little bit on this, but are we saying they have to verify it from a second source? Is that then what is the verification that we're talking
about? The accuracy
about
has to be verified. However, however, I don't know, however they do it.
Well, I believe that the intent is to if you purchase a set of bulk information from a certain source, that periodically that under the 30 days is that every 30 days where you regularly get your information, you go and get an update and upload it. You'll get an update and upload it. And so my main concern is that we start going down the road of the dissemination, we may be asking the business screening services to do more than what we're asking here, which is that every time you know, within 7 days of giving some information about Jim Johnson, they have to go and update, which I think is a little bit too onerous on the business screening services. I think it's important to ask them to give them. I mean, it's predictable and reliable. They can set their own calendar. You know, every 30 days they can automatically just do the update. I think it's better, fair, and better from a management standpoint to just fix it at the 30 days than to try to be creative about how we go about doing that. Just my thoughts. Senator Higgins.
Then, Madam Chair, I think verified is the wrong word. I think updated is the right word. The accuracy has to be updated every so often, whatever that so often is, if that's what we're saying. Because to me, I mean, until we just got to this discussion, I was assuming that it meant that it had to be verified through a second source somehow. And I was trying to figure out what court, you know, what a second source for a court record or an arrest record or something would be, because it would all come back to the same place. So I think what it is it has to be, the accuracy of the record has to be updated.
Senator Higgins, I hate to argue with an English major. I hate to argue with an English major. But the record gets updated. The accuracy, once the update takes place, the accuracy then would get verified. So, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I hope I'm not arguing with the chair in this point. I'm just wondering, when you say accuracy verified, the accuracy must be verified. Well, for example, if an arrest has now become a conviction, that doesn't mean that the arrest is not an accurate arrest. In fact, you know, so if you're just saying that they have to verify the accuracy of the information, the fact someone was arrested is not inaccurate information, but it may have evolved to a conviction, or it may have evolved to to something else. And so I guess I'm just confused about whether our point is to try to get them to change to the most recent reflection of where we are in the progress. For example, if we want them to have to include the fact that the record was that a charge was dismissed, then I do think we have to say something about updated, or somehow make it clear that we're not just that we want all the latest information and not just whether it's accurate or inaccurate.
Members,
I got it.
We've got two more bills. All right. So if we're going to continue to work on this bill, and if people have amendments in terms of language, and we need time to do that, we may have to set this bill aside and let you all think about the wording that you would like. But if you've got I'm just looking at my watch, and we've got two more bills to go. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, let's try this. A business screening service must not disseminate a criminal record unless the record has been updated within the previous 30 days.
Sounds good.
Senator Betzel.
Okay.
I like that. Okay.
Senator Higgins,
so
repeat
Madam
it.
Chair, that would be on line 1.15, delete accuracy of the.
Why don't you just read the whole thing?
Okay.
Because the council will have to just renumber everything. So,
okay. A business screening service must not disseminate a criminal record unless the record has been updated within the previous 30 days.
On that amendment.
Aye.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I have an amendment that Senate Council wrote up. And maybe she can pass it out. This deals with the definition of business screening service.
On the Neville Amendment. Senator Neville, do you want to explain it to us?
I can just, it's short. I would just read it. It would, business screening service would mean a person regularly engaged in the business of collecting, assembling, evaluating, or disseminating criminal record information on individuals for a fee. And in addition to excluding the government entities, we'd also exclude the news media.
Love it.
So what we're adding to the definition basically is that they have to be regularly engaged in the business and they have to do it for a fee. This would take a few people out of the definition. It would narrow the definition.
Senator Betzel.
I can go with it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schad.
Madam Chair, if I might just ask Mr. Horner, and is it Ms. Bach, or I'm not sure what her name was.
Ms. Buka?
If, Buka, I'm sorry. To respond. I mean, she was, I don't know if she, if we intend to include
she'd still
her
be
service,
out.
She's still in there, I
she
think.
She would still be
okay,
out.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's, I haven't thought that all through as to whether or not that's what we want, but okay. That's
we're looking for the, Madam Chair, this definition or rewrite of it is designed to make sure we just get the people who are making money okay. off of disseminating data.
Okay, I think so.
Ms. Buga, sorry to call you to the table. Senator Neville has already answered.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. All right. On the Neville amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposing say nay. The amendment passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Orman.
I'd like to offer another very brief amendment to the paragraph that defines criminal record, subdivision 1, subparagraph C. We say criminal record means a record of an arrest, citation, prosecution, criminal proceeding, or conviction. This goes to Senator Limmer's concern, so I'm glad he's back in the room. I wanted to say, include language that says the criminal record for purposes of this section, meaning it shouldn't apply to any other definition of a criminal record, but I think we should include incident reports for purposes of this section so that the people that are the subject of those reports can insist on the accuracy or have a cause of action against the business screening service if the report is inaccurate.
Senator Orman, line 1.4 says, definitions for purposes of this section.
Okay, good.
Is that good?
Then all I need to do is add incident report to paragraph C, and I'm good to go.
Incident report.
So after the comma before the or,
it's going to cause more people to freak out, but I'm
add incident.
Before arrest, yeah.
Makes before sense. Arrest. Incident. Report. On the Orman amendment, Senator Betzel.
This will, I support it. It broadens the bill quite a bit, but I support it.
I'm sure.
Senator Limmer.
Is the intent of the amendment to allow incident reports to be passed to other entities, or is it to seal that information from forward progression?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, the purpose of the amendment is that, at least I think the whole bill, the guts of the bill, is to allow the subject of a criminal record to insist upon the accuracy of the report on the reporting service. And he was concerned about the incident reports where a tenant or landlord, one or the other, might be talked about in an inaccurate fashion because that incident report is made available on a business screening service. And all my amendment does is make sure that the subject of that report could then insist on the completeness or and accuracy of that incident report and have a cause of action against the business screening service if they did not report it accurately or change it when they were notified about that.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Usually a reporting agency is just taking the public record and passing it on. So is that you're now making it the responsibility of the reporting agency to determine its accuracy. Is that correct?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair. I mean, perhaps the amendment does go too far, but I'm concerned about incident reports that are being passed along, as you were talking about with the tenant reporting agency, that often have impact on the ability of someone to get a home, to get an apartment. And so we want to make sure they're accurate. And Senator Limmer, if you don't support this amendment, neither do I.
I think it's withdrawn.
Senator Ortman withdraws her amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the record should at least be clear on what the purpose of this is. This would not require any business screening service to get involved in a dispute about whether the incident report was true or not, only that what they're reporting is an accurate reflection of the record. Is that correct? Yes?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Neville, that's what I've believed. But
okay. Okay. I just wanted to make that clear for me, if nothing else.
Was I too presumptuous, Senator Limmer? Do you want to offer your own amendment?
No.
Senator Betzel, on the bill.
I don't know that this has to go anywhere else. I would move that Senate File 914, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair, one more question, if I may.
Senator Neville.
Again, just to clarify, the witness or the testimony we heard from the witness who was arrested in the hospital, this bill won't help him then. He will have to get an expungement of the arrest record. That's the only way. I mean, this will still allow all the arrests from being until they're expunged. Right. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's my reading of these two
Senator
bills.
Senator Betzel.
Okay.
All Madam right. Chair. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I would be interested to hear what Mr. Tennyson has to say in terms of, I think, do you want to? No. Well, I don't know if you think that it should. I mean, I'm thinking that I'm sitting here wondering if it should come to commerce or business, industry, and jobs, but I don't really.
Does the chair want to see it?
No.
Does the chair want to see it?
No, no.
That's a good question.
No, this chair wouldn't do that, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I appreciate the invitation, but I respectfully decline.
Oh, I thought you wanted to say something.
Well,
if
you wanted to have it there, I'd be happy to have it there, but I'm not going to suggest that.
Yeah, no. Madam Chair, this is.
I would suggest some other changes, but that's another matter.
Madam Chair, that's what I wanted to hear, actually, in the first place, was how he was responding to what we had done.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I think those have been amendments that we would be happy with. I think they help the bill a lot. There are a few other issues I'd like to continue to talk to you about. And I'd like to thank Senator Betzel for being very gracious to me. And we're trying to work out some amendments. I'd like to continue to do that. And I'd like to thank the committee for graciousness with which you heard me. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, I don't think
it. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, it's far too complicated, I think, in terms of the legal issues in here that it would go to any of those other committees. Even though it does have an impact on an industry, I think those issues are more related to the matters before, you know, Judiciary Committee subject matter like First Amendment. And
all right. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. many people will know that I'm a very strong data privacy advocate, but during those previous debates, we have always had the discussion of where the balance point is between public protection versus private interest. And I'm not sure if we've had that discussion yet. And I'm afraid I'm going to be voting against the bill. I just don't think it's ready yet. And I would like to have more, if I could turn the clock back, or if this would have gone to Data Practices Subcommittee, maybe we would have had that discussion, but that balance that we try to incorporate into all our data privacy, I don't think has yet really been achieved, and at least by this senator. So I'm going to be voting against it because I don't think it's ready for prime time yet.
Well, Senator Limmer, all the members of the Data Practices Subcommittee are sitting at the table today. I don't know what difference that would have made to have sent it to the subcommittee.
Well, Madam Chair, every time this committee meets, all the members of the Data Practices Subcommittee are here. So if that's the logic, why have a Data Practices Subcommittee in the first place? The Data Practices Subcommittee is designed to focus a disciplined discussion on data privacy issues before it comes here. And so hopefully that some of these issues can be kind of ironed out. And we've had a very long discussion on this particular bill, and I've listened carefully because it's kind of gone around in a circle and around in a circle and around in a circle. And it's not to make any judgment about how we do things here, but some of the basic discussion points that we always have on data practices, I think, are maybe missing. And maybe in our desire to get this bill out, because it does have a fairly noble point of conclusion, we want to make sure that certain data that characterizes a criminal activity goes forward, and if there's any doubt that a criminal activity never occurred because of a failure to convict, does not, we're going toward that goal, but I don't know if we've realized where the balance point is.
Well, Senator Limmer, I think that you're a very valuable member to this committee, and the contemplation and the recommendations of a data practice subcommittee would also be taken into consideration. If that is an issue, then I think that you ought to raise what the data privacy concerns are that you have, and we ought to have a discussion in this committee on those concerns. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, just to respond to what you said, if we still had Subdivision 2 as a part of this bill, I would be more likely to agree with you, because I think that with Subdivision 2, it included an intent that we all want to accomplish, which is to protect people from adverse actions taken against them from premature records. But we did have to balance the freedom of information with the privacy concerns, and that seemed, I think, premature to the committee, and I guess I can't speak for everyone else, but that was the reason why I voted in favor of eliminating this subdivision, because it was premature in my mind the way it was written. But that being said, I think what this bill now does is basically just ensures the accuracy of information that's out there, that it has to be updated, so it provides, I don't see the need to balance those concerns in the form the bill is now in. And then it also gives some recourse to people when inaccurate information is there, and a way for them to attempt to make sure the information is more accurate. And so that's why, I guess, from a data practices standpoint, I feel comfortable voting for the bill at this point.
Madam Chair, all I'm doing is telling my opinion on the bill. You guys can make up your own mind. It hasn't been the first time when I've cast a single no vote. I'm just leaving a public record of saying why I'm not going to vote for it. So go ahead. Do what you want.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I know that you want to move this along. I'm sorry to raise another issue. In Subdivision 6, we have questions about service that disseminates the criminal record information in this state. But if you go to Subdivision 2, it just says you can't disseminate, and it doesn't say where. And I'm thinking, what happens if you have the dissemination that's out of state? Well, if the dissemination is out of state, then there's no jurisdiction to serve them in the state.
Maybe. Maybe not.
But is the intent of this bill to prevent dissemination just within the state? And if so, can a data collector here send it to the parent company in Wisconsin?
If they've got a presence in Minnesota.
Senator Betzel, do you have a thought? Mrs. Secor.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, the intent of the statute is to prohibit dissemination of information that is out of date, stale, wrong. The language in Subdivision 6 is intended to make the burden less onerous on an indigent person, for example, in the state of Minnesota, who would, but for this provision, have to deal with diversity jurisdiction in federal courts. So by asking the data harvester, who may be located in New Jersey, for example, to submit to jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota, it simply venues it here and makes it less onerous for the person seeking a remedy. As far as restriction on dissemination, our goal would be to restrict dissemination of any inaccurate data anywhere.
Okay, but just for the record,
Senator Neville,
Madam Chair, the dissemination for purposes of jurisdiction, the dissemination has to be in Minnesota.
Mr. Secor.
Yes? Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, I believe that's the only way we would trigger the jurisdiction of the state of Minnesota.
Right. So for multinational companies who are doing background checks, if the delivery of the report is to some place out of state, then this bill won't cover it.
I believe that, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I believe that is correct.
I thought that was important to get on the record.
Easy.
Ms. Janicek, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members, I'll be very quick. Sarah Janicek on behalf of the Consumer Data Industry Association, which is the trade association of the federal, the credit reporting agencies. Obviously, amendments have been flying here fast and furious, and I have no idea what the major companies are going to think of the bill in its present form. We have great confidence in having worked with Senator Betzold in the past and members of the committee that if you want to, in the interest of furthering things along, pass it out of the committee. We feel real confident we can work with the bill author and other concerned people to try to get to some sort of a resolution on the different issues. But a lot of different things that you've raised are covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and it'll take us a couple days to analyze what we've got with what current law is federally.
Senator Betzel.
I renew my motion, but I would suggest people be quick because things don't stay on general orders very long in the Senate anymore. So, I renew my motion.
Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate 914, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
The bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your diligence and your care.
A 10-minute recess. 6 o'clock. So people.
Members, we're going to recess until for 10 minutes until 6 o'clock.
You have to wait till. Is the mic on? Okay.
You can repeat that.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair and members, we're going to take Senate File 823 first. And this is a relatively simple bill, members. We're just asking for the a lot of nonprofit organizations that offer various services have volunteers who offer to come in and do programs. And this specific program that we're looking at is a program that focuses on youth in youth mentoring. And they've come to ask us to basically help them underwrite the background checks that the volunteer mentors have to go through. Not so much to eliminate that, but to help them pay for the background checks that these volunteer mentors have to at this time pay for it. And I believe the organization pays for half of it, and the mentors pay for the other half. Is that correct?
Not in all cases.
Not in all cases.
The majority of mentor programs pay for background checks.
So, in essence, the bill is asking for $320,000 to be appropriated from the general fund to help pay for the background checks for these mentors. And then $10,000 to be appropriated to the Commission of Public Safety that will be appropriated to the mentoring partnership to help do some background check training. And I have with me two individuals who are going to speak to the program and to the piece of legislation.
My name is Joellen Gonder-Spasek. I'm the Executive Director of the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for hearing this very important child safety issue before you. I'm here today on behalf of more than 400 youth-serving organizations. We are an umbrella organization, if you will, that serves and supports 170,000 children, many of which are in your districts. There's kinship programs from Bemidji, the Northfield Mentoring Coalition, Volunteers in Action in Brooklyn Park, Chanhassen Schools, Coon Rapids Learning Center, and those are just to name a few. As you know, mentoring our youth is very important to their ultimate success in life, and mentoring is proven to help children perform better in school. It helps them resist the use of drugs and alcohol, and in some cases it keeps them out of our correction system, which ultimately costs us a lot of money, and it gives them hope for their future. A mentor's impact on a child's life is a quantifiable investment to help our children become productive members of our society. Unfortunately, county, state, federal, and private grant funding has been cut or eliminated for many of these programs over the last several years, and they really struggle to maintain program quality. We know that many mentor programs, especially in greater Minnesota, operate on budgets of $5,000 or less annually. This makes it extremely difficult to conduct state criminal background checks on all potential volunteers. These background checks are part of the overall risk management process that we promote, advocate, and provide training for, and helps keep young people safe, ultimately. One example, the Big Brothers Big Sisters organization in St. Cloud recently told me they spend $15,000 a year on conducting background checks for their bigs and their program. In a recent prevalence of mentoring study conducted by our organization, we found that about one-fourth of these mentor programs do not conduct background checks. And in some cases, it could be because the volunteers work in very highly supervised settings, but these criminal background checks, we believe, still should be performed. The majority of the mentor programs that do perform these checks do only a state check through the BCA. And while we ultimately would like to see all the mentoring programs conduct federal criminal background checks, we believe our bill represents progress towards ensuring our children's safety. And we need to make it easier and more affordable for these mentor programs to do the good work and to protect the children in their program. And this bill will make it possible. Last year, we introduced similar legislation, which did not pass due to a lack of funding. However, our efforts along with others, have raised the visibility of this issue, as indicated by the proceedings prior to this. And as a result, we are invited to participate on the Criminal Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, the background check delivery team, that looked into a range of issues regarding background checks. And among the recommendations that the task force delivered in December of 2006 were two relating to background checks for volunteers. The first was to extend mandatory background checks for two categories of people not currently covered under statute. First is the K-12 volunteers, student employees, and independent contractors working in schools. And secondly, employees or volunteers for public, private, and nonprofits who work with children and are not checked under another statute. An important caveat to the first recommendation that was that before those background checks would become mandatory, there must be in place a funding mechanism to ensure that they could be provided at no charge. The goal being not to discourage volunteerism, of course, by making the law too onerous for these programs, again, supporting the children and families. This leads to the second recommendation that state agencies provide background checks at no charge for volunteers for nonprofits or political subdivisions when mandated or authorized by statute when not otherwise reimbursed. Senate File 823 is an interim step toward those recommendations. Our bill is limited in scope and provides funding for state background checks for volunteer mentor programs that work with young people and families. The legislation also appropriates money to fund training, as referenced before, for these mentor programs and how to use the information and handle the data that they receive from the BCA in an appropriate manner. Without proper background checks, our young people are frankly put at risk, and our mentor programs cannot afford to take that risk. We ask you to support Senate File 823 and to fund the BCA to perform these state criminal checks and ensure that an additional 40,000 kids have safe mentoring relationships in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Ma, do you have another witness?
Yes. We actually had a mentor program from Minneapolis, the kinship program, and unfortunately he had to leave and was not able to testify. But I wanted to provide a little bit of information regarding background checks.
Excuse me, ma'am. Yourself. Would you mind stating your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sorry. I'm Mayan Kapanke with the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota, and I'm also a mentor through Kids and Kinship. There are programs that currently do not do the background checks, as Joellen had mentioned, because they work in a supervised setting. But what we wanted to provide to you is the information that if the background checks are funded, some of these community centers that offer mentoring programs are able to give
their youth more opportunities. So they're not just spending time in the community center, but they can actually take them to a Twins baseball game or a Gophers game, so they can provide other opportunities to spend time with these youth. So on behalf of some of the community-based programs that operate in supervised settings, they would like to have these background checks because they currently can't afford it, and that's why they're not doing them. So these background checks would help them provide more programming for youth that they're working with currently.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for these witnesses or Senator Moy? Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to make a comment. 2 years ago, I was asked to be a mentor by a young lady from Chaska High School. And so we worked through the mentoring program, and of course I said yes. And then I was sent the paperwork. And the paperwork was a lot of information about myself and then the request for me to write a check for $40. And I was a little surprised, to be honest, that I was asked to write a check for $40 to do that. I did do it. And I was happy to do it. It was a great experience. She was a fine young lady, and she spent a lot of time here at the Senate helping. And she went to visit the sheriff's office and the jail. I mean, she went around the county. She went around the state. She learned so much. And it was a great experience for her and as well for me. And so I support what you're doing. I do think that it will encourage more people to be mentors if they don't have to personally invest in the project, not only their time, but also their finances. So I support what you're doing, and I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
Senator Foley?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am deeply disturbed by the necessity that you have to have background checks in these situations. It's just incredible that we have so many segments of the population that are deprived of the right to work at a given job, or to live in a certain place, and all of these things. And I fully support your legislation, Senator Mao, but I just... The way we're going, it's got to the point where it isn't safe for anybody, because nobody wants to go through all the hoops to do that. One of the things that Senator Ortman talks about is a lengthy, questionnaire or answer sheet, and I've had that own experience myself doing freely legal work for legal aid. And so while there's not much we can do about it, I had to say what I thought about it.
Senator Moy?
Madam Chair, if there are no further questions from the members, we do have one other member in the audience who has expressed a desire to want to testify against this bill.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville?
I do have a couple of questions. First of all, there isn't any law that mandates these background checks. You're doing it because you choose to do it. For liability purposes,
yes,
mostly.
Yes, Madam Chair, right? Senator Neville.
And then the second question, how did you come up with 40,000?
We looked at the number of volunteer agencies right now that are currently not doing the background checks, and there are a couple of large organizations such as Girl Scouts and Junior Achievement that utilize about 10,000 volunteers annually. And they're not currently doing background checks, but they would like to move towards that system, but the cost is just too great. So they have other safeguards in place.
So, Madam Chair, will this 40,000 cover most of them?
We spoke to Senator Neville. We did speak to these programs, and they were very supportive of this bill because they would like to go towards doing background checks on their volunteers.
Okay,
and
but
so
I just want to know, does this cover 100% of what we think we might need, or half, or what?
Ms. Kapinski? Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it's hard to predict how many background checks we might do in the biennium, but we thought that this was a good start. And then by having a number, we would be able to analyze after 2 years if we needed more or less.
Thank you.
Senator Neville, thank you.
Thank you.
I think now Mr. Neumeister would like to testify.
Today.
Okay. Welcome to the committee again, Mr. Neumeister.
For the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. It'll be strictly 3 points. And then if someone could please pass this out to senators, I'd be obliged to you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the first time, we're setting a precedent. We are basically funding background checks for private sector entities that we have not done before. The state has paid for checks in regards to, like, if you're licensed or there's some tie into the state with a license or something to that extent. So this is, as best of my knowledge, a new thing. And so I think that's important. Secondly, I ask myself, you know, why do we just want to do it for folks that are mentoring? Because there's a lot of folks that do a lot of things. And in my studies of a lot of things, a lot of states basically say, well, let's give it a discount. Let's say $4. So I think another option would be, you know, say $4 for all under youth type activities. I think that could still be done this year. And then give the $320,000 or maybe $100 or whatever it might be to the BCA that might have to hire a staffer extra. Now, folks from the BCA are aware of other states that offer that kind of discounts. Depends on what approach you do. Internet, as Senator Neville and I have worked on the internet to where criminal records are free to a certain extent on BCA, there are discounts I've seen in other states that are doing what is being proposed here, like $4, $5, you know, but it's very defined. Now, the third thing that I gave to you, I think, is a very important thing because we're doing this on 40,000 individuals over the next 2 years. Currently, as the language proposes, I can basically get a informed consent, and then I can get the information, these entities, I guess there's like 400 of them, and then they get this information that deals with issues of timeliness, accuracy, reputation. You've heard those kinds of things and have already said those kinds of things before. Now, to solve that problem, I gave you all a copy of the statutory background check. This is one of the 40 statutory background checks. And it's probably the most complete, and it was based on a federal law that was passed in 1991 called the Children's Protection Act. And what it does, it basically ties in, and you see the definition of children's service worker. It's broad. It's to deal with volunteers, with mentors, and all that. You go then to 299C.62. It talks about the kinds of notices that you get. It talks about the kinds of rights that you'll be informed that you get a copy right there, because if there's anything inaccurate or whatever, you can, you know, you get your rights, you get notice. So what I'm trying to say is that if you're going to spend $320,000 on 40,000 people, Minnesotans here, I think rather than say, well, you know, I've spoken with the folks, and I've worked with this organization because some of these folks were on a committee that I've been on for the last, year and a half, dealing with expungements and all that. So if the bill's going to pass as is and is not going to look at what other states might do and maybe do half price type $4 checks, at least I would suggest tie it to 299C60 through 299C64, so then rights of the individuals who are the subjects of this data would be very clear to them. And Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Moore, would you like to respond to any of the comments made by Mr. Neumeister?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there any further discussion among the members?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm asking a lot of questions.
Senator Neville.
You get a background check for $8 under this bill, or that's what we're giving public safety. I didn't think you could get an FBI check for that. So this is just the state background check, which would include, as we were discussing in the last hearing, arrests and convictions. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that is correct.
Okay.
And if I could add, too, I think we'd support that this information be free of charge for all volunteer organizations, particularly those working with children. But because I think the cost would probably be prohibitive, that we're, again, our constituency is the mentor program, so that's what we're advocating for, and we think it's the right step in the right direction.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
If all you're going to get from this bill is the state data and not the FBI data, you can get, assuming that you get the person to give you his name, his date of birth, and his Social Security number, can't you go on the internet and get that for free?
Ms. Gardner.
That was something I worked on over the past few years. As long as you've got the identifying information, isn't that good enough?
Ms. Gardner-Spacek.
Or Ms. Kopinski's going
Ms.
to
Ms. Kopinski?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it is a great step in the right direction to have that information on the Internet. However, I believe that currently our mentor programs also get some arrest information, which is also important for them to have. So by doing just an Internet check, they just get the convictions.
So, Madam Chair, we could solve your problem just by having the Internet availability also apply to arrests, which you can't get unless you have a Social Security number. I mean, maybe I'm opening up another huge debate, and I don't want to do that.
He looked over here at all these places.
So after all the debate we had in the last hearing, you're telling us you need arrests. You need arrest information. We seem to be arguing against that maybe the last time. But
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, last year we asked for state and federal checks. And for the past 8 months, I've been serving on this background task force that many of you have heard about and have seen the reports. And when we considered coming back to the legislature for our bill, we realized that the federal background checks they're not accessible enough for rural mentor programs and Greater Minnesota programs. And quite honestly, it's kind of intimidating for some volunteers to be sent to the county prison or jail to get their fingerprints done. So we felt like mentor programs might not utilize the federal checks as much as they would the state background checks. So we realized that the fiscal note last year was a little high for some folks, so we wanted to reduce that. So we came to the legislature this year just for the state background checks, knowing that in the next couple of years when the federal background check system gets a little more accessible, that we would come back and possibly advocate for that as well.
Well, Madam Chair and
Senator Neville.
Senator Ma, we could accomplish exactly the same goal and have it applicable to almost all these other groups that are may background checks by just directing public safety to make available the arrest records on there that haven't been expunged. So, I mean, they are public records. If you went into the lobby of the BCA and punched it up, you could find all of that stuff. Or for $10, you can get it with the person's consent. For a lot less than $320,000, we could just say, whatever public record we have, it's available on the Internet, and then peg it to the last four digits of the Social Security number, which you would have to get authorized by your subject. So I'm not going to amend your bill, but I maybe just am planting a seed that there may be a more efficient way to do that. And Mr. Neumeister would probably object to that.
Well, Senator Neville, frankly, I'm open to any suggestions that doesn't cost money.
Yeah.
For this committee, my main concern was that I looked at the $330,000 and I wondered how many employees the department could hire to then give these background checks for free to every mentoring volunteer program out there. So, I'd be more than glad to take your suggestion, because it has to go to Senator Higgins' committee.
Madam Chair and Senator Ma, I mean, it's an area that I have an interest in because I carried a bill to make the criminal background check available on the Internet. And it was, I think, $5 or $7 at first, and now it's free. But the only thing that's on there are convictions, Minnesota convictions. But I'm hearing from this group now, they don't need the FBI. I mean, you can't get that on the Internet. You got to pay for that through the FBI. But if all we're trying to get for a lot of these groups, like mentoring groups, and there are probably others, is the Minnesota public data, I'll bet for $50,000 we could have public safety, the BCA, make all the data available with a little more assurance that we're getting the right person. So you'd have to have the date of birth. You'd have to have at least part of the Social Security number. That's a much bigger issue, though. But frankly, as we compare all these bills that we've been talking about, as you try to coordinate them, what's the theme? I guess where I'm coming up is that the theme is whatever information goes out, whether through an agency or whether you get it privately, it has to be accurate. And secondly, once it's expunged, nobody gets it. So if it's expunged in the BCA, you won't get it either. But until it's expunged, why shouldn't you? And even if it's an arrest, until it's expunged, as long as it's accurate, and as long as you get enough information from the subject to to be sure that when you type it in on the internet, you're getting the right stuff. And then we could save $8 for every single. And why should it be limited just to mentoring groups? Maybe there are other groups that could use it too.
Senator Moore, what's your wish at this time?
Madam Chair, I prefer not to spend more of the committee's time to try to draft an amendment here. If the committee feels that they would like to, if Senator Neville is willing to work with me, I'm willing to entertain that. I am going to be making a stop in Senator Higgins' committee to talk about the money. I'm sure she'll be happy to kick me out if there's no money attached to it and there's a different solution.
Okay, so
I'd like to move the bill.
Okay, Senator Moi has moved Senate File 823 with a recommendation that we...
Senate File 823 would be recommended to pass.
And be re-referred to...
to the Committee on Finance.
The Committee on Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair and members.
Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, next I'd like to pick up Senate File 643... Chair and members, Senate File 643 is an attempt to impose some child protection measures from online sexual predators. The internet gives adult sexual predators unprecedented access to children. And according to the Pilot Class Foundation, one half of teenagers communicate over the internet with people they have not met. Additionally, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children notes that only 25% of children who receive an online sexual solicitation tell a parent. Some predators do not initially overtly ask the child for sex, but instead groom the child for future sexual solicitation by communicating with the child over the internet in a sexually explicit manner. Minnesota law currently prohibits an adult from sexually soliciting minor, but does not make it unlawful for an adult to engage in sexually explicit communications with a child, such as by sending the child materials involving sexual conduct, penetration, or performance. Yet, sexually explicit communications from an adult to a child can have extremely harmful consequences on the child and frequently are designed to groom the child for a sexual encounter. So, the Child Protection from Online Sexual Predators Act, which is this bill, will make it a crime for an adult to engage in sexually explicit communications with a child and define such behavior as a felony punishable by up to 3 years in prison and $5,000. Madam Chair and members, I believe Washington, Texas, and Georgia already classify such conduct as a crime. I have with me today an expert in the area who is going to give some testimony on the issue. And then I believe Mr. Voigt from the Attorney General's office is here to answer specific questions on the mechanics of the bill. Then we'll be willing to take questions.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Broughton. I'm a professor of pediatrics at the Mayo Clinic. But I'm here as a private citizen. I'm not representing Mayo at all on this. I also have been a board member of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children since it started in 1984 and served as chair of that board for 13 years. And it's through my work with that that I'm here today. And Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee, I welcome this opportunity to be here today to discuss how the internet is used to commit some really horrible crimes against children and how we can combat this problem. I think you have a statement that I had written out in front of you, and rather than just read that, I'll go through and highlight some points with it, but you have the actual statement. The internet has become a primary tool to victimize children today, and this is due to its widespread use and its relative anonymity that offers child predators the protection of being able to hide much easier. One of the most important tools against these crimes is the cyber tip line, which is sometimes referred to as the 911 for the internet, and it serves as a national clearinghouse for information and for collecting leads and tips regarding crimes against children on the internet. And it's a multi-agency group that's located at the National Center headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia, and it includes the FBI, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the U.S. Secret Service, Postal Inspection Service, and the International Crimes Against Children task forces, as well as local and state law enforcement agencies. In the 8 years since the cyber tip line began its operation, the National Center has received and processed more than 457,000 leads, and that has resulted in the arrests and convictions of hundreds of people. Child pornography makes up about 90% of these leads, and of these photos, of these child pornographic photos, 80% are of prepubescent children. 39% are less than 6, and 19% are less than 3. Child pornography is a major tool that's used by pedophiles in molesting children, and that's important to realize. The reports that come from the cyber tip line are referred to the 46 federally mandated and funded ICACs, including Minnesota's, which is based primarily with the St. Paul Police Department. They not only investigate the referred cases, they also are proactive by going onto the Internet and posing as either a minor or a parent with a child and being solicited by a predator seeking sexual activity with the child. You may wonder why they would pose as a parent with a child. Of those child pornography cases that I was talking about, a little over 50% are put on the Internet by a family member, and the vast majority of those are by parents. And so it's a wider spread problem, I think, than some of these people realize. The number of reports since the cyber tip line opened in 1998 has increased by 400% over the past over each year. If you watch television, programs like the recent Dateline series have demonstrated the amazing audacity and the number of adults that target kids online for sexual purposes, and I'm referring to the programs where they've been actually getting people to come into homes and looking for kids. In research recently published, it was found that 1 in 7 children between the ages of 10 and 17 who are regular Internet users will be sexually solicited online. To put that into perspective, realize that conservatively, 85% to 90% of middle school and high schoolers are online regularly. And so when you're talking about 1 in 7 children being solicited, and about 1 in 3 of that number are actually really quite frightened and upset by it, it's a huge number of children that are actually being solicited. And Senator Ma mentioned the 25%, and actually other statistics would indicate that it may be as much as 10% of the solicitations are actually reported to authorities beyond parents, so that parents are actually stopping a big percentage of those as well. Recently, there's been a great deal of attention to the social networking websites. Now, these are primarily marketed and utilized by young adults. But kids are attracted as well, and they have been joining more and more often. And there have been many instances where offenders have taken advantage of these kids. Some of the social network sites are aimed at defined communities, like specifically for students of a college or of a high school. But they do permit registered users to create an online profile, which can include photographs, and categories of interest such as music and sports, as well as an online journal. These are highly personalized to each individual person, and they're extremely detailed in many cases. And if you go on and look at these, you can be stunned with how much you can find out about an individual. And if this individual is a teenager, it's really quite concerning at times. Children consider this a very easy way to connect with new friends and to find new people and share thoughts and feelings. But unfortunately, child predators have also found this to be valuable, and they use this information posted to pretend to be someone with shared interests, and they develop a cyber relationship. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples of people that have actually used this. And these are real cases where the parents found out what had gone on. These are two 11, 12-year-old girls who were communicating with 12, 13-year-old boys. In one case, there was a series of a few notes that went back and forth that became more provocative, talking about kissing and hugging, and I'd like to kiss you all over. And then finally, the boy says, do you have a camera? And the girl says, I don't, but my friend does. Why? And he said, well, I would like to get some pictures of you both with clothes and without clothes. Well, this 13-year-old boy actually was a 29-year-old man. And the parents found out about it and reported that to the FBI. The second one is even more concerning in that this is, a 13-year-old boy that was writing. And in one of the notes, the girl had mentioned that she was going with her family to a resort in Wisconsin. And he said, wow, you won't believe this, but my father is going to be at that same resort at a conference. And I would like to send some stuff with him to give to you. Would that be okay? Well, it turns out that this 13-year-old boy was a 42-year-old man, and, of course, the father that he was sending was himself. And so these are just a couple of examples of real cases that are quite frightening. Webcams are another part of this. They offer the exciting ability to be able to look at somebody that you're talking to all over the world. It gives divorced parents a chance to actually visit online with their children in distant cities. There's some real positives with this, but some kids are getting cajoled or as jokes or on dares are putting across pictures of themselves, either naked in some cases or in very provocative poses. What they don't realize are that these pictures can then be sent to anybody, and it's very easy to intercept them. And photographs like this and activities like this can then be used against these kids in a form of blackmail to make them do more and more and ultimately to solicit them. So these are the tools that are used. The teenage years are a time of great personal exploration, and that's natural. That's the way it should be. However, with a new form of social interaction being over the Internet, we're exposing children literally to a world of potential danger, and that's where we come to this bill. And it will significantly enhance the ability of law enforcement and prosecutors to investigate and convict those who prey upon children using the Internet, because it will add to the current specific statute specific language encompassing the range of conduct by these predators, and that's important, and the various methods used to entice children. And possibly the most effective improvement is the provision which bars the legal defense that a law enforcement officer was involved in the detection or investigation of these offenses. This will greatly increase the conviction rate and rid the Internet of these predators, hopefully. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children applauds the efforts of Senator Ma and the Minnesota legislature and the co-sponsors of these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Broughton. And before we begin discussion, do you have an amendment, Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would like it in. And members, the A3 amendment is a delete-all amendment. There are a couple of areas where we just wanted to do some cleanup and clarification. It doesn't really impact the bill substantially, but going through the bill with Senate counsel, there was just a couple of areas that we needed to clean up, and it was better to just do a delete all. So let's put on that amendment, and then I can kind of walk through the amendment.
Are you ready to move the amendment?
Yes, I move the A3 amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Moore moves the A3 amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Members, the A3 amendment is very similar to the bill. The only thing that is eliminated is that on the A3 amendment, we define child, we define sexual conduct, we define solicit, and we've taken out sexually explicit because we're building the sexually explicit concept into the act itself in the back. So as you go down the amendment, we talk about what the prohibited act is. That stays the same. The internet computer solicitation of a child stays the same. And let's see, where did we build solicitation in? I lost my train of thought. I'll go back to that. And then in the back, what we've done is under subdivision 2, if you look at line 2.4, we've just reworded that in the amendment.
basically taking out or ratify. Mr. Backus, can you identify for us what we've done with sexually explicit?
Mr. Backus,
the amendment.
Madam Chair, members, yes, the definition of sexually explicit is deleted from the bill. However, the concepts are built into the substantive crime. So on lines 1.24 to 1.30, essentially they're reinserted, or the concept is. And the main point is talking about in clauses 2 and 3, relating to or describing sexual conduct. That's the substantive language that really was the definition of sexually explicit. So that, again, that's put back into the substantive crime in those clauses.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Moy,
members, the statutory references on line 1.110, the 609.341, I think it's the reference to the crimsex definition. And the other one, 617.246, is a reference to the pornographic section of the law. And I believe we've copied that for your reference. Is it in the packet? I believe we've copied that for your reference. Mr. Voigt, again, is here. We'd be glad to take questions on the bill.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moy, I noticed that your bill creates a felony, and it's a three-year imprisonment, up to 3 years. How did you arrive at the three-year versus, let's say, a five-year? This seems like it's a serious enough crime. Was there any, what was the consideration for a three-year? I
don't think we have changed. Senator
Moy? Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm going to have Mr. Voigt from the Attorney General's office answer that.
Mr. Voigt?
Madam Chair, Senator
Welcome
Limmer.
The
penalty provision is identical to the penalty provision that was already in for solicitation of a minor. And the idea in leaving the penalty the same is to maintain the proportionality with the rest of the criminal sexual conduct statutes, which get progressively higher when you move from, say, precursor behavior to actual sexual contact.
Members, are there additional questions?
There are none, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that Senate File 643, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor, or does this go to finance? Referred to the finance.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, the question is on the motion of Senator Moy that Senate File 643, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Adjourned.